This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Dr. John Del Cambry. Today is 26 April 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Dr. Del Cambry is joining me from his office, I believe, in Odessa, Texas. Dr. Del Cambry, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some background information from you, if I could. Could you tell me when and where you were born?
Fort Worth, Texas, September 17, 1948.
And what were your parents' names?
Alfred and Doris Del Cambry.
Alfred and Doris, very good. What did your parents do for a living?
My father worked in the motion picture business. He'd actually been an actor. He played in several movies back in the 30s. And then after the war, where he had joined the Navy during World War II, and after that, he came back to Dallas and worked for National Screen Service as a manager of distributing.
That's very interesting. What kind of movies did your father act in?
He was in Car 99 with Fred McMurray. He had just a walk-in part on Wharf Angel with W.C. Fields and Mae West. He was the guy who closed the gate on Wagon Wheels with John Wayne. And then he made a movie of his own in 1939 about a flying doctor in Alaska who crashed and had to survive. The name of that movie was Tundra, T-U-N-D-R-A. And that was remade in 1949 with the title Arctic Fury, where they dubbed his voice because he had such a strong Texas accent.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
That is really cool. What about your mother? What did she do?
She worked in my grandmother's art supply store. She was just a clerical, you know. She had no education past high school and no big clerical skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
No, I was the only child growing up.
Only child growing up. Mm-hmm. That is really interesting. Now, growing up, did your father talk to you about his experiences in the Navy in the Second World War?
No, he died when I was 9 years old, and so I never got to. We got to see anything more than pictures, and he never went overseas. He spent his entire tour between Athens, Georgia, and Monterey, California. He was an athletic director. He was a all Southwest football player for Southern Methodist University, and played in the 1932 Rose Bowl against Stanford. I believe it was Stanford that year. But he didn't talk much about the Navy, other than, you know, the places they travel, like Monterey and Athens and stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, where did you grow up?
Mostly in Dallas, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sent to military school in Georgia, Riverside, in Gainesville, Georgia. And I lived off and on with my dad's family down in southern Louisiana, in New Iberia, and spent time in places like Colorado and things like that.
So can you take me through the various stops along the way here, growing up in Dallas and then moving around? What kind of timeline are we looking at? What were the years like?
Well, he died when I was 9 years old, and right after that, I started getting sent away on my own. I went to Colorado, one of these boys' camps, and then I went to live with his family, his aunt and cousins, down in southern Louisiana, and would spend part of the summers down there, part of them in Colorado, and part of back in Dallas, and I spend a lot of Christmas down in southern Louisiana, in New Iberia with the family down there. And then when I was 12, I went to Riverside. I was in eighth grade, and stayed there for 5 years and graduated in 1966.
So you graduated from the military school there in 1966 then?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you might tell me, what was the environment like there at the military school for these 5 years? What was the curriculum like? What were the activities like? What was it like to be in military school in the 1960s?
Well, when I first started there, I was 12 years old, and I had I needed my ass kicked, and they gladly accommodated me repeatedly. You know, and you learn to do things that you're supposed to do. You learn not to do things you're not supposed to do, and falling short of that, you learn not to get caught. And, so, yeah, it's probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. One of the things that and I didn't know it at the time, the hallmark that is responsible for what I'm doing today is one of our band director there was a scuba diver, and he taught kids how to dive. And there was only a handful of us that took the lesson. Anyway, I took those lessons and learned how to scuba dive when I was 15. And that ended up getting me where I ended up in the Marine Corps and ultimately civilian job in medical school.
Yeah, it's really interesting. What about the curriculum there? Like, what were you studying in military school?
Stuff that I didn't think was appropriate. Of course, Latin and the hardest math courses that they could make you fit to. Of course, the usual American history. Then, of course, we had military science for ninth grade. Everybody had to take ROTC and learn all the military sciences and stuff. That's pretty much what the curriculum was. The other part of the curriculum was all athletics and military. Everybody had to participate in athletics, so that swimming, football, boxing, weightlifting, and gymnastics and stuff. It was a very regimented existence for kids. I mean, every minute of the day was already planned for you.
Right. Now, did you find that you took to this kind of structure?
Oh, yeah, I did. After getting my ass kicked enough times when I was 12 years old, I learned to wise up and get with the program. I couldn't have imagined going to high school anywhere else.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this on a couple of occasions, getting your ass kicked, as you say. Mm-hmm. Was this a literal thing, or was it a figurative thing, or what was it... what do you mean by that?
I mean the older cadets, they were high school students. I was eighth grade with a big mouth and couldn't keep things straight, couldn't get the stuff done that I was supposed to do. it was a culture shock, for
sure.
A 12-year-old you put in that environment and wise off the people. And, I got beat up by the older kids. They didn't. It was kind of like the Marine Corps, actually. Marine Corps back in '66 went to boot camp. The drill instructors didn't really take any crap off of anybody,
Sure.
And neither did these older. I wasn't very big at the time. I hadn't hit my growth spurt yet, but I was still stupid enough to challenge people. Learned that lesson over and over again. If they taught me anything during those couple of years, it was how to defend myself and when to keep my mouth shut.
Well, it sounds like this was a good training in a variety of ways for your future in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, it was extremely good because when I went to the Marine Corps, they didn't have to teach me how to march or salute or the manual of arms or anything about the.
Mm-hmm.
Or very much, we used the M1 rifle in military school, and of course the M14 when I went into the Marine Corps. So I was pretty well up on it. And of course, there's nothing that can prepare you for everything that the Marine Corps is going to throw at you. But physically, I was already in pretty good shape. Although Marine Corps doesn't matter, you're going to leave boot camp in better shape than you arrived in.
Sure. Now, you graduated in 1966, you say, from the academy. Now, did you know for sure that you wanted to go to the Marine Corps? Was this something you desired to do, or?
No, I actually joined the Marine Corps before I ever graduated. They had a 120-day delay. I had wanted to go into the military. I decided that during probably early in my junior year of high school. And I wanted to be a paratrooper, my mother would not sign for me because I was 17, because she said the Army would screw you. but that's the only way you could be a paratrooper, almost. And so she talked to the Marine recruiter, and she felt he was a nice, honest young man. Said, all he promised you is 3 years of a hard time. And she said, okay, I like your honesty. I'll plan for him to do that.
So your mother was kind of a driving force behind this then?
Well, no, she was. She didn't want me to go in the service.
Oh, is that right?
No, she didn't. She didn't want to. But she had to. She had to give her permission.
Sure.
So that's how it ended up in. I love the Marine Corps. That really wasn't a very that wasn't a hard choice for me to make. Mm-hmm. I kind of jump out of airplanes. Okay, yeah, fine, Marines.
Well, tell me about the process by which you enlisted in the Marine Corps. What was the process? Where did you go to basic training?
I went to basic in San Diego,
mm-hmm.
and, at MCRD.
Right.
That's boot camp there. And then after 2 months of San Diego, we got shipped up to Camp Pendleton, did a month of ITR, Infantry Training Regiment, mm-hmm. and then after that, half a month of basic infantry school, and then we came home for, I think, a couple of weeks leave, and then we went back to Camp Pendleton for a month, a little bit more than a month, maybe 6 weeks or so of staging battalion, where we concentrated on jungle warfare, and then we were off to Vietnam.
I wonder if you might take me back through this and spend a little bit more time on each of these stops. For instance, with boot training or boot camp there at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, what was boot camp like in, say, 1966? What was the pace of life? What was the regimen like there? Tell me about boot camp.
Well, it was it was a challenge. Even coming from a military school, you know, you have waking up screaming at you every day, and of course the physical and the mental torture was it was kind of exciting. You know, quite honestly, I wasn't a 22-year-old guy with a bunch of college and a bunch of opinions. I was a ripe 17-year-old kid, just wanted to eat up as much of that stuff as I could,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted everything they could throw at me. And I got it.
Tell me about the physical training. What sort of things would you go through on a daily basis?
I run every day. Did 1-3 mile runs. Then we had the obstacle course, and of course, Marines spend probably half of their day in the dirt doing push-ups or exercise we call the squat. So it's kind of like a burpees mm-hmm. that you see now, and then pull-ups, run. Your exercise in regular boots and utilities, or in helmet and rifles. Everything's always PT oriented, and even the drill. So we spend a couple hours or more a day out on the parade deck, doing rifle drills and stuff. Everything was just precision. It was perfection. Absolutely no room for mistakes or errors,
mm-hmm.
and no forgiveness.
Now, you say that you're talking about precision and no room for errors, and this is the mid-1960s. What would happen if there were errors?
If one Marine, or one recruit, you weren't Marines yet, one recruit who fouled anything up, the entire platoon, there's 90 people in the platoon, would have to pay,
mm-hmm.
And they would correct things and straighten people out, give them direction about what you're supposed to do. But if you didn't square away after you were given direction or correction, the entire platoon would pay. So that's a way to build teamwork,
mm-hmm.
And it's a way to engender a sense of responsibility on everybody for everybody else.
Right. Now, even though you had this kind or a similar type of experience, I guess, at a lower level of military school, did you find that you did okay in basic training? Was it a much of a physical or mental challenge for you there?
Yeah, I was promoted to a meritorious promotion to private first class when I graduated from boot camp.
Hmm. So you did really well, it sounds like.
Yeah, 10% of the class would get promoted. I was one out of 10. And, I scored 100% on the written exams. There was two written exams during boot camp. I got a perfect score on each of them. And, qualified with the rifle and everything. And passed all the PT tests, of course. And so, I was really, it changes you. No matter where you come from, you don't leave boot camp the same person that you were when you arrive. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I wonder if anyone would mention to you anything about Vietnam. I mean, the Marines have been in Vietnam since they splashed ashore out there in March of 1965. Did anyone talk to you about Vietnam, about the potential of going to Vietnam, or was that completely off your radar?
In the Marine Corps?
Yes.
Did anybody in the Marine Corps talk to us about it?
Yeah, talk to you about what was going on in Vietnam, that you may wind up in Vietnam, anything like that.
Oh, no. Vietnam was the only reason that we existed.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't exist to do anything else. We the Marines exist to fight. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a foregone conclusion that if you join the Marine Corps, that's exactly where you're going to go, mm-hmm. and you're going to be fighting in some capacity,
Right, right. And Vietnam was a war going on at the time, so you
yeah,
all.
Yeah, and that's what Marines. Yeah. That's why they exist. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, okay. Your next step was ITR. Now, where did you go to ITR again?
Up at Camp Pendleton.
Camp Pendleton. Okay, tell me about ITR.
So I just 2 miles north of San Diego.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the ITR.
Well, it's a 4-week program, and it's all infantry training. And at that point, nobody's a turd or a maggot anymore. everybody's Marine, so you don't get called a piece of shit to your face the whole time. They'll say, "Hey, Marine, do this, do that," but the consequences are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of PT for things that you screw up. But you're able to get liberty on the weekends from ITR if you're not on watch.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we learned, we spent a lot of time learning how to attack and do squad tactics, platoon tactics, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And shoot at real targets.
Right. Now, what kind of weapons training are you receiving here?
Oh, in ITR, the basic weapon that we used just to shoot at things was the M1 back then, but we also learned all the automatic weapons. And back then, in Vietnam, we would have the M14 with the selector switch on for automatic, but we trained with the VAR for automatic weapons. Anyway, we fired the M60, the M79 grenade launcher, the gas and the napalm flamethrowers, through grenades. A lot of humping up and down those hills in Camp Pendleton and mountains, and attacking uphill, attacking downhill, attacking through the through the woods, through the swamps.
Mm-hmm.
Just attack.
Right. So pretty good training, I guess, then, for what would eventually come in Vietnam later on, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's as good a training for the jungles as you could get in Southern California.
Now, after this 4-week course, ITR, what's your next step?
Next step was basic infantry school, and that's just more of the same, a little more detailed, a little more fine tuning of mostly squad and platoon tactics,
mm-hmm.
Patrolling and ambush and things like that.
So
compass, map and compass, they teach you that. The land navigation I already knew. I had to teach that in high school. In your fourth year of ROTC, you only have to teach a class, and some guys would teach a machine gun, some guys teach grenades, or some guys would teach something else. I got assigned to teach land navigation with map and compass, so having to teach that when I was a senior in high school, I was pretty well versed in land navigation. So
yeah. And how long did this basic infantry course last?
I think that was a little over 2 weeks.
A little over 2 weeks.
It was either 2 weeks or 4 weeks, I forget. Because I got into boot camp June 23rd, and I left for Vietnam on December 7th. And by that, I'd had 2 weeks at home. Everything else was filled in with staging, battalion, BIS, ITR, and boot camp.
Yeah. So you're looking about 6 months before you wind up in Vietnam.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. Right, right. Now, when do you ship off for Vietnam? This would be November, you say, of 1966?
No, December. Pearl Harbor Days.
December, okay.
Pearl Harbor Days, 1966.
All right, now, when you're done with all of this training, and again, you've been training for 6 months or so, and you know that Vietnam is on the horizon. That's not, you know, a possibility. You know that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. I absolutely do. When I got out of BIS, and my next orders were, instead of being sent somewhere, the East Coast, West Coast, or my orders said staging battalion, and staging battalion is where you go on the way to Vietnam.
Yeah. What did you know about what was going on over there at that time?
I did everything that the Marine Corps was telling me, of course, you get the Marine lens that you're looking through there, but, they were telling us mostly for the Viet Cong. The North Vietnamese Army was not, they probably did occupy as prominent a position in our training as the Viet Cong, the guerrillas. But as it turns out, we ended up fighting a whole lot more of the North Vietnamese Army than the Viet Cong.
What were they telling you about the Viet Cong? What did you learn to expect from them while you were training?
Well, Charlie was he was a cunning little bastard. Probably not as well trained. Couldn't shoot as straight as we could. But farmer died by day, fighter by night. Somebody that you thought you could trust, but you couldn't. Because anybody could be a Viet Cong. We're going to go over and win the hearts and minds, but we're going to kill everybody who even could be a Viet Cong, But the Viet Cong were more of a, they presented us more as a caricature, very unsophisticated, but cunning, resourceful little fighters who were, civilians who were guerrillas and stuff like that. But we ended up fighting a much different enemy than we got over there.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how they might have trained you in terms of what to expect from them. What kind of tactics did they train you to expect from the VC?
Oh, booby traps, punji pits and mace balls and, explosive things, ambushes, ambush, defending against an ambush. Which in the Marine Corps, the way you defend against an ambush is you attack it.
It wouldn't be the Marine Corps if you didn't.
Yeah. Because you spend all day searching for a target, and somebody ambushes, and your problem's solved.
Right. Now, what did your family think when you received your orders? I mean, you're going to staging battalion, you know you're going. What did you and your family think when you knew that you were going to Vietnam?
I was excited. My stepfather was very proud of me, and my mother, she really didn't have a clue. She lived in a different world. It was inconceivable to her, that of all the people that you hear about on the news are getting killed, that one of them could be her son. I think it didn't really sink in to her that her son was going to be in some of the places he was going to end up and get his ass shot off like I did,
Right. All right, so you got your orders. You show up to staging battalion. You're leaving on Pearl Harbor Day, you say, 1966.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about this trip to Vietnam. How do you get over there?
Oh, shit. That was the biggest kelp barge you ever saw in your life. The General Leroy L-10. He was a troop carrier. I think it would carry about 4,000 troops, and I think they rolled this thing out of mothballs. It must have been built in World War One, and there was 4,000. I think 4,000 Marines. I mean, just packed like sardines against this damn thing. And everybody's excited, going down there. We're driving down the rain to San Diego to 32nd Street to catch that ship on December 7th. We pulled away from the dock. Went up to San Diego Bay, and just as soon as we got out past Point Loma and started hitting the swells, right about chow time in the afternoon. And they were serving, I remember this, greasy hamburgers with tomatoes, pickles, lettuce, mustard, no bread, and green Kool-Aid, and green Jell-O. And as soon as we hit the first swell, everybody started puking. And God, the tables, the trays, the decks, the stairwells, the decks outside, the rails, everything was covered with vomit. The sinks in the heads, they're all full of vomit. The toilets didn't flush, the sinks didn't run, and there was just vomit everywhere. And I'd been on boats before, and I wouldn't get sick by the motion, but everybody's tripping everywhere. Jesus Christ! I went out to the rail, lean over the rail, get some fresh air. Well, I lit up a cigarette, looking out over the ocean, and as I was sitting there, I got splattered in the face by a guy puking his guts out on the next deck up, leaning over the rail. You know, so I went up in the bow and tried to get washed off by the bow spray, and then I got chased off of there because that was secured. You know, it was quite a deal.
What do the sailors say about this when you guys are getting so sick over it because of this?
Well, there were very few said. I think a lot of the crew we didn't see them much. We were pretty well kept isolated from everybody else, mm-hmm. You know, and so I didn't really get much exposure. I don't remember much about them. Mm-hmm. I think they also had some civilian merchant marines on there, and but I don't remember being exposed to them much. And
now this is going to be take a few weeks, of course, to get over to Vietnam. What do you guys do? There are 4,000 Marines or so crammed on this ship. What do you guys do to pass the time? What's going on?
Sit out on the deck and play cards. Read. I read Leon Uris's Battle Cry. Hmm. You know, it's a big thick book. I read that whole book there. But there really is nothing to do. You know, if we would on one side of the ship, they would see flying fish. Somebody would pass the word. Then you'd have thousands of guys going over that side of the ship to see the flying fish. If you see dolphins out there chasing the bow wave, you know, the decks, and the rails would be full of people leaning over looking at dolphins. Is it a turtle? God, anything. It was incredible. You know?
Yeah. And how long a trip was this?
18 days. We hit, we left December 7th, and we reached Naha, Okinawa on Christmas Eve, and we were given, 18 hours liberty. And so they let all those Marines off the ship in Naha, Okinawa on Christmas Eve. So we jumped in little kamikaze cabs. I remember me and about six other guys jumped in a little kamikaze cab, straight to the whorehouse and straight to the bars, back to the whorehouses, back to the bars. And we ended up crashing in a little tiny Okinawan hotel, like six Marines. And we were sleeping in the tubs on the floor, in the beds, in the chair, you know, and got up the next morning in time to get breakfast, get a bottle of sake, and head back to the ship and get our sake confiscated from us when we got back on board.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So after you leave Okinawa, what's your next stop?
Da Nang. Yeah, we were there within a week, and we got processed in Da Nang, I don't think we were there for a whole day. We got off the ship, and we knew where we were going. We got in our assignments when we were aboard the ship. And by New Year's Eve, I was at the rock pile in Vietnam, up in I Corps.
Hmm. What were your initial impressions of Vietnam sailing into Da Nang?
Well, the first thing I remember looking over the side of the ship, and you see all these snakes in the water. You know, the water was just—it was brimming with these sea snakes for some reason. That was the damnedest thing I'd ever seen. And then they put us on these mic boats to bring us into the landing area there from the ship. And then you see Vietnamese women squatting to take a piss in right in the street. And you see the black teeth of the betel nut, and the little motorcycles going all over the place. And just right there, in the civilian area. of Da Nang, and it was something, you know.
Now, Da Nang's going to be obviously a very busy place. What did Da Nang look like? How did Da Nang strike you?
I only saw that small portion of it. You know, they huddled us over and got us on, I think we were taken over to the, I believe, yeah, it was the airport, or the air base there, and we caught a C-130, and we didn't really see much of Da Nang at all. It was straight through town, but not enough to even absorb Da Nang. The only thing I remember is what I saw, when I just told you, when we got off the ship right there before we landed, and then, you know, we were hustled up. We were listening to, you know, orientations. You know, we had the staff sergeant giving orders and orientation of Vietnam. Then next step, then we broke up into different groups depending on where you were going, and smaller groups. And I ended up on a C-130, landed in Dong Ha that night. And you know, Dong Ha was rained. It was December monsoon. It was full of red mud. It was cold, and everything was tents and sandbags. And you know, I spent the night there and couldn't wait to get to the field. And you know, I got my ammo and my weapon and all that stuff. And I don't think I was in Dong Ha for, I don't think I was there for longer than 24 hours. And I caught a helicopter, CH-46, out to the rock pile out in the field.
Now, are you just finding your way by hook and by crook? You know that you have to be at this place by this time, and you're just finding.
Well, there's always somebody that leads you. You get on this plane there. Get off there. You know, go wait in the truck. You wait by the truck, and then board the truck. Take you where you need to be. No, everybody's going to make sure you ended up at the place. They were going to leave an 18-year-old kid to his own recognizance to find his way around a place like that. You know, there's always going to be somebody to tell you exactly where you need to be.
Sure. And what unit were you going to be attached to?
First one was India Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines.
3-3 Marines, okay. And you say that they're at the rock pile at that time?
Right.
Okay. Now, you are headed to your new unit, and you don't know, probably, I would assume, you don't know anyone who's there. Is that correct?
Out of everybody I trained with in boot camp and ITR, there was a handful of us that have been together since then.
Oh, is that right?
Myself, a guy named Jimmy Dugan, Neil Aldridge, Lee Amon, Tommy Allen, and that's hard to think of right now. Neil and Tommy are dead. Jimmy lost the use of his arm. Who else did I say? Lee Amon. He survived, but he got blown up a few times, as I did. But but yeah, Neil and Tommy were killed.
Wow, it seems to be a little unusual that you would know this many people going into a new environment like this and going into a new unit like this.
Well, we all joined up to a company, India Company, and so India Company probably had 90 people, I'm guessing. So we were backfilling people who had, you know, for people who have been casualties or who've been who rotated out back home.
Yeah. All right. Well, you arrive at the rock pile, and this is either late December or early January, I guess.
It was New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve. Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the rock pile. The Marines talk about it in these interviews. I'd like for you to give me a description of what the rock pile was, what it looked like, the level of activity, what was going on there.
Well, young 18-year-old kid and flying out there, it was during the monsoon, and these little, I call the little low-hanging clouds over these really spectacular black pinnacles sticking up out of the valley. They're like puffs of a dragon's breath, And the rock pile was just a huge monolith sticking up right out of the middle of the valley. And of course, it was surrounded on north and south sides by really lush green mountains and rolling hills. And there was another smaller rock pile-like structure just a kilometer or 2 kilometers from it. And then leading down from the north was Razorback Ridge. It's another black rock. It looked just like a razorback coming down there. You know, the North Vietnamese had these catacombs of tunnels and that thing. And they were just all over the place up there. But I mean, everything was green, and it was cold and rainy and stuff. And then when we got, when I flew out to the rock pile, on the New Year's Eve or the day before. You know, we landed on a muddy LZ, and we were hustled off the LZ to carry ammo boxes and stuff. We got met by the company gunny, whose name was Alphonse Pichon. Just the meanest son of a bitch I ever met in my life. Don't know his name. But so he ate it. We called him the goddamn gunny because everything to him was goddamn this and goddamn that. It's his favorite habit. You know, roll up your goddamn sleeve, get up the goddamn hill. You know, so we just called him the goddamn gunny. a great Marine, a great leader. But God, he was the meanest son of a bitch I ever met in my life. I carried his body to the LZ when he was killed on in March, about 3 months later.
Wow. What was it like for you to be joining this new unit? The third had been out fighting before, and you're new into this.
Yeah, I'm the FNG, the fucking new guy.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe let you know. You know, I kinda, when I go up the hill to join my new squad, you know, they had just come back off of patrol. And we lived in holes in the ground, a foxhole. And, of course, you know, after a week, you prove your position. So you dig out the back of the foxhole. You make a little area to sit down in. It's all mud and, you know, dirt. You cover it with ponchos as much as you can. And then we had a sleeping area in the back covered with ponchos. And a poncho was made out of bamboo, you know, just enough for a couple of guys to go and hit the rag. But then, you know, the squad was waiting for me, and this one guy completely had the whole crotch of his pants torn out by the jungle. His balls were hanging out, you know, and these guys were just out there smoking. All of them had their sleeves neatly rolled up against, you know, above their elbows, because the goddamn gunny would have your ass if you didn't do that during the day. But they just come off patrol, and I remember the squad leader, he yelled at me. I was kind of standing off the back, you know, out of the way, and I said, "That's your new squad, go over and join them." And they were having a debriefing after they got off the patrol. And then the squad leader, Corporal Steele, he yelled at me, because I was, you know, I had bright new green uniform on, and I didn't look like these other guys. You could tell I was new. Right? So he said, "Hey, you going to stand out there like a goddamn Amy steak? Get over here if this is your squad."
Welcome to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Well, what was it like? I mean, these guys battle tested. They've been out there, like you say. They look a little rough. All things considered, you're brand new. What was it like to get to know these guys, and how do they treat the FNG once you?
Oh, they were fun. I mean, they couldn't wait to pile their stories on me and their bullshit, you know. And they put me in a bunker with Erickson and Millett. Millett was from Canada, for Christ's sake. I wonder if I could join the United States Marine Corps. I don't know, you didn't have to, you know. But he prided himself in being the only guy that could hump all the gear and a radio, you know. Erickson was kind of a shitbird, but he was funny. He was a nice enough guy, you know. And he'd actually captured a North Vietnamese soldier. He ran into him, and the guy didn't have his weapon, and Erickson had his in the Vietnamese, and threw his hands up right away. Erickson didn't know what to do. So he got a free R&R out of that for cash.
Better to be lucky than good sometimes.
But those guys would argue all the time. You know, both of them were just a couple of shit nerds, just like me, you know. It's funny. I mean, the leaders, the squad leaders, and the team leaders, and the platoon leaders, they're all very welcome. Platoon sergeant was Sergeant Roach. He was another mean son of a bitch. Very strict, but very good leader, very fair. You know, but boy, would this guy have your ass. God damn.
What kind of things would he look for to go after someone?
Well, anything that would ordinarily piss off a Marine leader, he'd be very attuned to that. Like the gunny, you know, we had strictly everybody shaved every day. We got in the goddamn field, you know, nobody looks at you, but you have to shave every day. And you have, you know, during the day, you have to have your sleeves rolled up above the elbows if you're up on the hill. And if you're out on patrol, of course, you roll them down. The night they roll down. One of the things, we were going to be attacked. There's just intel had that the North Vietnamese were just going to come and swarm all over us. And Erickson and I were trading watch down the hole. And when my watch was over, I was supposed to go up into the hooch and take my boots off, you know, or, you know, wet socks or anything, and air her feet out and go to sleep. Well, I thought, well, fuck, if we're going to be attacked tonight, I'm not going up there. I'm going to stay right down here in the hole and, you know, and be here in case we get attacked. Well, shit. So when I relieved Erickson, he came down to take over the watch. I just curled up in the corner and went to sleep. Bobby, goddamn if Erickson didn't fall asleep and he got caught. And so what happens is the guy checks the lines. He tells Sergeant Roach that these two assholes are down there sleeping on watch. But which one's on watch? In fact, I don't know. so we both got held. We spent about half an hour in Sergeant Roach's bunker just getting our asses reamed, you know. And he didn't give a shit that I was going to be ready. He said, no, you're trying to fuck up your damn feet by not taking the boots off you, son of a bitch.
You were not going to escape that one way or the other, were you?
Yeah. there was no way I was going to get out of that. I wanted to be the best Marine I could be, and then I fucked that up.
how long is your squad or even company?
The squad, we probably had about eight guys in the squad. I can't remember all of them, but we had about eight guys. Normal squad would have, you know, 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
We probably had about eight.
So you're a little undersized at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, under strength, yeah. How long are you in, are you in the back here at the rock pile before you go out on your first patrol?
Oh, a couple of days.
Yeah. And what do you do during that couple of days? Just kind of get used to things?
We go out and look for the enemy, look for evidence of the enemy. And if the enemy didn't want to be found, he wouldn't be found. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd find spider holes, we'd find caches of this and that, you know, hooches, you know, we'd find evidence of them in a bunch of different places. But if he didn't want to be found, he wouldn't be found.
Yeah. I wonder if you could take me on this patrol. How does a patrol form up? What kind of intel are they receiving? What are their orders going to be? Who is where in the squad? Who's doing what? For someone who has no idea what a patrol would look like, a squad-sized patrol would look like, tell me about it in detail.
Well, you get you kind of do these on a rotating basis. One day you'll have patrol. Another day you'll be in the area doing working parties. And another day... you'll be working part of it on a night, and at night you'll go on an ambush, which is a patrol that you'll go out somewhere, you know, after dark and set up to ambush anybody that comes along a path or a road or something like that. But a patrol during the day, you get a warning order, and they bring us into a bunker and give us the intel about our area, give us the route that our, you know, where our objectives are in a patrol. Tell us what the route should be. Basically, you know, we have to make it from point A to point B, and how circuitous of a route you take from here, that's up to your discretion while you're on patrol. You know, you use the safest and or the most efficient way to get there. You know, and then we'll get used to knowing what we're looking for, any evidence of the enemy, and, you know, report back anything. That you see, and if you don't see anything, still you'll report back and give a sit rep, a situation report every hour. You know, just check in on by radio from your report, and that you'll have certain benchmarks that you need to make in your report to where you are based on the benchmark. You never give your exact position on the radio because somebody could be listening,
right.
But you tell them, you know. There's already pre-designated coordinates that you'll call A, B, or C or something like that, and say we've reached this one, we're on the way to that one, something like that.
Right.
And then when you come back later in the afternoon, the first thing you do is gather up at the usually the platoon headquarters and get debriefed by somebody from intel about what you saw, where you went, what route you went, and what you don't find is probably just as important as what you.
Can you expand on that a little bit? You talked about looking for signs for trails or booby traps or things like this. Tell me about this, what you would see and what you wouldn't see, and why it was important.
Well, the things that we would see out there, again, booby trap, you know, punji pits and things like that. Now, not up there in the DMZ, not where we were. That was all Vietcong stuff. These are the General Giap, the North Vietnamese commander, said one time that his statement was that General Walt has 6,000 Marines stretched tighter than a bowstring to contain my 35,000 troops in the North Vietnamese 324B division up there. So there's 35,000 of them, about 6,000 of us stretched between the Laotian border and the South China Sea. And, you know, so there was evidence of them. Any place that you found an empty village, with any structures on it, was probably a place where the North Vietnamese would come and gather. That would be one of their checkpoints or one of their resting points or something like that. We'd find spider holes that they would use to use as arms cache, or they would use to hide. But ordinarily on a regular squad size patrol, we didn't find a whole heck of a lot. It was on the bigger operations where we found stuff and we got in the bad shit.
Yeah. What sort of things would you be looking for, and what sort of things would you report back, even if you hadn't found anything? Like you said, sometimes what you don't find is important.
Oh, we would love to have found the enemy. We would love to walk up on an enemy and got in a firefight and killed all of them, but it just didn't happen on patrol up there at that time. The things I can remember finding are structures out where we wouldn't have expected the structure. You know, huts, on stilts, fairly well-kept huts, but they were empty. Not real villages, but a little area that had several huts in it. Certainly no civilians had been living. There was no farming going on. Those were probably North Vietnamese gathering areas for when they were around. And spider holes and equipment. Sometimes we'd find North Vietnamese equipment.
When you're preparing to go out on a patrol, what sort of things would you personally bring?
Oh, that's everybody had seven full magazines of 7.62. I had the M14 with Selectus, which was on that rifleman, and everybody carried six M26 grenades. You carry enough sea rations for the day, usually two canteens of water. What we had back then was canteens, and the shard, your cartridge belt. Back then, we were not wearing flak jackets, even the helmet. So when I first got there, we didn't wear those on. We wore soft covers. We were pretty light and stealthy.
And you were you were a rifleman rather than helping hump ammo for, say, an M60 or
mortars. Oh, no, we all had to do that. We all had to carry a mortar round. But on squad size patrol, you don't carry mortars.
Yeah.
But you may carry an M60 machine gun. If you got one of those, everybody helped. They distributed the ammo among the squad. Also, we had a thing called a pyro bag, a pyrotechnics bag, full of flares and spokes and stuff like that. Nobody ever used that. I think it was just a way to fuck with Marines and make them carry this thing on the patrols like that. But whoever fucked something else, you end up carrying the pyro bag. Me and Erickson got to carry it a lot because he was always fucking things up.
What was it like for you to go out on, say, your first patrol? I mean, you're in Vietnam for the first time. It's cold. It's rainy. It's wet. It's bound to be miserable. You're going through different types of whether it's vegetation or the landscape, the geography. Take me on one of these things. What's it like for you?
Well, for me, the important thing is I was 18 years old and I was gung ho, so I wanted to do everything exactly right. I wanted to impress everybody with how I could, just fit in with the squad and everything. And it does take time to get your footing in Vietnam. I mean, the mud is different to walk on. The rocks are different to walk on. The elephant grass is like razors. It'll cut you to shreds, you really have to learn to walk through this jungle and these mountains, And, I left no doubt with anybody that I was willing to learn, and walk point. That's the other thing I could do. I could take the point because I could read a map, you know.
Right.
And I, you know, I intruded on the older guys, you know, corporals and stuff that do that. I was like, I can do that. Let me do this. Where are we at, you know? And first they thought I was a pain in the ass. Then they appreciated the fact that, hey, this guy, we put him on point sometimes. I thought it was cool. I had an automatic rifle, you know. I the only one in my fire team that had the, you know, a full automatic. So, you know, I was 10 feet tall, bulletproof and invisible, you know.
Right. You didn't go on point your first time out, did you?
No, not the first time.
Yeah. No. Yeah. But it could be obviously a very difficult thing, a very complicated, complex thing to walk point. How do you learn to do that? Do you talk to other people? You watch what they're doing?
No, you just hook on to the guys that know what the hell they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you follow them and let them chew your ass about what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong.
Yeah.
You know? That's it.
Hmm. Now, when did you first engage the enemy? Do you remember the first time?
The first time I ever saw the enemy, I think it was in February. It was Viet Cong. We got intel that the Viet Cong was in a village called Kalu, which is just south of Quezon, by a few kilometers. And we had good strong intel that there was a cadre of Viet Cong in this village, and so they got us up late in the afternoon, and we took a convoy of six bys down the Highway 9 west toward the Laotian border. And about the time our convoy stopped, it was dark, so we got off the convoy in the dark and walked all night in the dark south toward this village of Kalu. And by sunrise, we had encircled this village, completely encircled it. When we were doing it, one or two of the Viet Cong got wind of it, and they tried to escape out through there. And some guys up on the hill got it, and they killed them. And that was the first dead enemy that I'd seen. They brought him out there and put him in the road, and my squadron said, "Hey, Del Camry, drag this dead duke off the road," you know. And so I grabbed the dead duke and brought him off the road into a little ditch off the side, you know. And then as we were providing security, and this is another where Erickson was there. there was one of the guys, or a water buffalo came through our lines and walked out and started going up the hill, and a guy came out to follow me, a Vietnamese guy, and it was motioning the Erickson, you know, hey, I didn't get my water buffalo. they didn't let him go, and ended up when the dog teams came through there, they you know, sniffing out the people they knew that were Viet Cong. This ended up being one of the Viet Cong.
Is that right?
He got captured. So at the end of the day, we rounded up, a dozen or a couple of dozen Viet Cong, and they were, you know, they were tied up, blindfolded, and shipped out on another truck with the Arvin.
Hmm.
That was the first enemy I saw. I didn't shoot any.
Yeah.
Any rounds at him that day. I did. My first firefight was probably a couple weeks later.
Yeah.
In the other side of the province.
Hmm. Well, that might be a good point to pick up with next time, Dr. Del Cambry.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Dr. John Del Cambry. Today is 29 April 2013. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Dr. Del Cambry is joining me from his vehicle. He's on the road right now, but we assure you that he is driving safe, hands-free, and all of that. Okay, Dr. Del Cambry, we left off last time. You're getting ready to describe this firefight, which you first really participated, firing your weapon and all of that. So take me through the background and this engagement.
Well, the first one wasn't really an engagement. It was probably in early February 1967, and I'd been there for a month and done several patrols and night ambushes and stuff, but we hadn't seen an enemy at all.
Mm-hmm.
We'd come across a few little areas of enemy supplies and stuff, but hadn't seen the enemy at all. But
one night we were going out on an ambush, and we were going down the road. It was absolutely pitch black, and we just barely could see the guy in front of us. And we were separated by less than an arm's length.
Hmm.
And my fire team leader was walking the point. I was right behind him. And all of a sudden, he grunted like he got punched in the stomach. He fell back against me and let off an automatic burst. And I just raised the rifle to my shoulder, and I fired just into the darkness right ahead of him, right over him, because I knew he was down at about body level. I fired 11 rounds. I don't know why I can remember that, but I can remember pulling the trigger 11 times.
Hmm.
And until I heard somebody cease fire. And that was Donnie Johnson, my fire team leader. And what happened was, we were walking down this road in the middle of the night to set up an ambush somewhere, and he walked right into the horn of a water buffalo, either walking or standing on the road, knocked him down.
Wow.
And that's all it was. And then we had, I think it was probably after that that we surrounded the village at Kalu and captured all those Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
The first firefight I actually got in and traded fire with the enemy was up on an operation near Conti Inn. In fact, most of our real heavy activity was around Conti Inn.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on a company-sized operation, and we had our whole battalion was actually up there operating, but our company was making a sweep and rounding a hill, and one of the other platoons had rounded the hill. Before us, we were coming around the back, and they were crossing the rice paddy on the other side of the hill, and suddenly they started taking fire, and we could hear the AK-47s going off just at the top of this little hill, and we weren't taking rounds. Evidently, the NVA were just they weren't looking down our side; they were looking down the other side, where they had a clear field of fire. And I had an automatic rifle then, and when I heard the fire, along with a couple other Marines, we started walking toward it with our weapons poised, and I took about two or three steps and just started spraying the ridge line up there. And I emptied one magazine, loaded up another one, and then all the shooting stopped, and we were told to hold our fire, and evidently... They'd had a few injuries of the platoon that was right around the other side of the hill from us, but the NVA, as soon as we started returning fire, they stopped it and ran away. I don't think they realized there was another platoon right behind them.
Mm.
And so that was the first time I fired my weapon at the enemy.
What is it like for you for this first time that you are engaged like this? They're shooting at you, you're shooting at them. What goes through your mind? What goes through your body? How do you react to this?
Well, you have to remember, I was 18 years old, 10 feet tall, bulletproof and invisible. So I was on cloud nine, and I'd finally gotten a chance to fire my weapon and be a Marine. You know, I felt like I was part of the platoon now, you know, and, in fact, one of the only pictures, there were very few pictures taken of me in Vietnam, was taken the morning after that. I was sitting in the jungle with my M14 automatic sitting in a little foxhole, and I said, that picture has been copied over and over. Everybody in my family has a copy of it.
Right. Hmm. So what happens after this particular engagement? I mean, it doesn't last very long, it doesn't sound like. What do you do afterward?
Well, we continued our sweep. We were, you know, sweeping the area around the TMZ for North Vietnamese, and we continued on our operation. We didn't, I don't believe on that operation, we didn't experience much more contact with the North Vietnamese. We were out there a couple more days. Went through a couple of villages where we stopped, and when we stopped, of course, the villagers came out and, with sick kids and people wanting this and that, all medical stuff, and our corpsman took care of the people there, and we set up, security for them and everything. But I think that was about all we saw of the enemy that time. And then we came back to our our positions around the rock pile by truck convoy, and then we started patrolling again. Then we that was around the end of the monsoons in February of 67. So the rains were letting up, and we were going to be called upon to go out and do more large company and battalion size and platoon size operations. And so it was a few more days of night ambushes, and patrols were not much happening before we got up again and boarded helicopters and went back out towards the area between Contien and GLN on another operation. Getting in towards March now, and the next big firefight we had was on all the big activities for me. The reason it's so easy for me to remember because they happened on prominent days. The big firefight was that we got into. I was on point. It happened on Good Friday, and that's when this guy Gunny Pichon, I told you this guy called the Goddamn Gunny.
Right.
He was killed that day. Also, Corporal Kelly, the guy who was making rounds on the perimeter of the night that he caught Erickson sleeping, he was killed that day. I carried both of their bodies.
Would you care to describe that particular engagement for me?
Yeah, I can remember it vividly. we'd been out in the jungle sleeping, you know, for probably 3 or 4 days. And I was on point again with the guy who was most experienced at point, Corporal Overholt. And this was kind of mid to late afternoon, and we had come across a little rice paddy, and he went up a little bank, and this guy had a sixth sense, and all of a sudden he just turned to his right, and he completely emptied a 20-round magazine automatic blast. I didn't see anything. And he jumped back over the dike, and he looked at me, and he said, "Get some automatic fire in there." And so I jumped up over on, over the bank and looked to the right, and there was rustling in the bushes and these camouflage fifth helmets rust everywhere, and you know, he started to return fire. And I that's when I leveled my M14 automatic and pulled the trigger straight back. Now, one thing about the M14 automatic, it doesn't have a buffer system on it, and if you're not leaning into it, and you pull the trigger back and hold it, it's going to knock you right on your ass, which is exactly what happened to me. Knocked me right back on my ass. And I got up, reloaded magazine. I had probably 7 or 8 magazines on. And I would unload one, slam another one into the receiver, and just open up again. Then they started shooting back. And, you know, the trees and the leaves and everything around me just started exploding. These guys were nuts. They were probably not 20 or 30 yards from me, and we were trading fire, and I was just cutting down the trees, cutting down everything around these guys. I was just watching the jungle just burst apart when I was spraying it with automatic fire. Let a clip go, and then put another one in, and keep firing. And then the fire got closer to me. You know, their rounds started hitting closer to me, and I think one of them got my canteen. So I went forward and dove behind a little tree for cover, and kept firing. The other guy in my fire team, I was a fire team leader then. His name was Dan Daly. He joined me up there on that little platform, and he had his head down, and he didn't have an automatic selector switch. He was just single shot, but he was firing just as fast as good. And then I was down to one magazine, and Overholt yelled from back in the. On the other side of the bank, he said, "You Marines, get out of there," because all the Marines were starting to come up on the bank and starting to lay down fire, and they were trading grenades and everything. It's funny, you know, we probably weren't spread out any more than 25 or 30 yards, but I didn't realize until later what was going on just a few feet away from the other Marines over there opening fire and trading grenades. And by the time Daly and I were empty, we dove back over the bank. A couple of our guys had been hit. Erickson, he had been hit in the neck with some shrapnel. He would survive it, but he'd been hit. Overholt's he had a concussion. His nose was bleeding, and we had walked right into something probably about a regiment size of North Vietnamese.
Oh wow.
And so we got lined up and started firing borders, they were firing mortars. And then one of the other platoons was called up on the sweep because a lot of us were low on ammo. And so while we held our position there, one of the other platoons swept through the jungle. And while they were doing that, Gunny Pichon was with them. And he got killed. They brought his body back. Also, Corporal Kelly, he was killed in that. And since I was just about out of ammo, having been, on point in the firefight, me and another guy, Long was his name, and some other guys, a couple other guys, I forget who they were, but we all grabbed each corner of a poncho, and we carried Kelly back first to an LZ that was set up through the jungle, and then on a little rice paddy pack behind us, and then we came back and got the gunny. And we carried his body. He was a big guy, and so he was a struggle. And we probably had to carry him, I'm guessing, maybe 60 yards through the jungle to where the Marines had set up a little LZ. And when we got the gunny back there, there was enough dead guys and wounded guys back there. There's plenty of magazines full of ammunition. So I was able to replenish mine and get some grenades and everything. And Long and I started to go back into the jungle to rejoin the platoon. But the thing that we weren't paying attention, and we had not checked on the exact place in the tree line where we had come out of the jungle. So we just went back into the tree line and started walking and walking and walking. And guess what? We were going the wrong way. We walked right into the middle of the goddamn North Vietnamese.
Oh, no.
Taking fire. We started taking fire from a sniper, and we couldn't see it. We had no idea where this was coming from, but, we got down and tried to move left and right. Every time we did, we'd get one or two rifle shots, and then maybe a couple more, and it was crazy, and we were trying to run. We didn't know which way to run, either toward the enemy or toward our guys. So we were just on our feet, just looking for a place to go. And these guys kept shooting at us. And then all of a sudden, the fucking ground just absolutely shook from under us. We had a phantom came in and dropped a couple of 500-pound bombs on the enemy. They were calling in airstrikes, and these things landed close enough to us to absolutely knock us off our feet, not by the blast, but just the ground shaking, the firing stopped. And I mean, we could feel the blast, we could smell the explosion and everything, but anyway, the firing from those enemies stopped, and we started doing that. We had no idea where we were, and so we started running to where we thought the platoon might be. And all of a sudden we started taking fire again, and so we ran out into the edge of the jungle where we could see. There was another flat area of a rice paddy, an old rice paddy. They weren't growing any rice there, and there was a bomb crater out there. It was still steaming, and so Long and I ran out and got into that because we could at least get cover for the bomb crater. And and whenever we'd stick our heads up, somebody would shoot at us. And thank God, whoever was shooting at us was not a very good shot. But we had the jungle behind us that we just come out of, and then we had a jungle probably 40 yards away from us the other way. And I think that's where the firing was coming from. And we were stuck there. Hmm. So we sat there for a minute or 2 minutes. I don't know, it seemed like an eternity, but I'm sure it was a couple of minutes. And so we locked it. Locked and loaded, make sure we had full magazine. We had a couple other magazines in our pouch, and Long and I were getting ready. We were just going to attack that, just shooting like hell. And we unsnapped our grenade pouches, and we were just going to attack and kill everything that fucking moved. And then all of a sudden, the whole jungle on that side started to rustle, and we heard movement and stuff. And there's a whole lot more of them, just one or two of these Vietnamese. We looked up there, but we weren't getting shot at. Mm-hmm. And we looked, and we thought, oh fuck, here comes the whole goddamn company after us. And then we started hearing voices, and we could make out the voices, and they were saying, motherfucker, goddamn shit, fuck. And it was, oh, shit, thank God, it's the fucking Marines. They were sweeping through there, and the guys that were shooting at us, were they must have hauled ass. So the Marines think, hey, what the fuck are you guys going up here? Don't even ask. You're fucking... I have no fucking idea. Where the fuck are we? So we, you know, in 10 minutes we joined back up with our platoon. That's how thick the jungle was.
Wow.
And so that night we made a tactical withdrawal to a high point just above that build where we could get resupplied, and we were planning a real big attack for the next morning. And of course. Going out there, the enemy chased us with mortars. They just mortared us for the rest of the afternoon and the rest of the night. But the next morning, we had airstrikes coming in, and then air resupply. We had the helicopters. We had a fleet of helicopters coming and bringing us more ammo, more grenades, flamethrowers, and then we lined up. And this was Saturday after Good Friday, and. We went down the hill, and then I got online, just, you know, shoulder to shoulder with a good interval between us, with assault line like that. And then they told us to fix bayonets. We're gonna fucking attack this son of a bitch. Probably 80 Marines. Excuse me. Online, fix bayonets. We leveled our weapons. All we had to do was flick it off safe and start shooting. And we started coming online down that hill through the jungle. And by the time we got into this field where the North Vietnamese had been, and we had to fight the day before, they were gone, leaving weapons and food and gear, everything. Huh. They saw us coming, I guess, and they just hauled ass. But they didn't run away. They kept far enough away from us where we wouldn't see them, but they would continue to mortar us throughout the day as we went and swept through this field and through the rest of the jungle and blew up all their stuff. But we spent the day doing that, and then we returned to that same hill Saturday night. And on Sunday, it would be Easter Sunday now, we came off the hill, went back through the hill, still no enemy, and then we started coursing southeast between probably somewhere around the Contien, just south of Contien, and headed southeast. And all day, you know, we get mortared a few times and find a little bit of shit, blow it up, and then or just almost at sunset, just about to get dark, we came out of the jungle in a little banana orchard and an old bombed out church. It was a Catholic church. There were those statues, you know, some of the statues were still intact, a lot of them were broken, the walls were kind of blown up. In fact, if you see the movie Platoon, the last battle, they have an old church there. You know, they had a Marine advisor for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he knew the story. This was May 15th, in April of 1967. We came out and through this little banana orchard, this old church, and there was a big field out in front of this church. And so also there was a little spring-fed fountain in the church. In front of it wasn't. There was no people there. It's just, you know, water that wasn't completely stagnant. You know, so we set up a perimeter right around dark, and I was selected to go out on a listening post, and I was going to go out with this guy Millette, who I think I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
He and I, Long, and one other person. I forget who that was, and. Anyway, it was dark now, and people were digging foxholes. We didn't have one because we were going to go set up by a little tree out there for listening posts. But as we were about to leave, Millette did a radio check, and it failed. And what happened was the battery was dead. So Millette had to go find another radio battery. And while he was gone, looking for another radio battery from one of the other guys in a platoon, they started mortaring us, and they just mortared the hell out of us. And... at first, you know, we heard the tubes popping. And we thought, well, hell, that's Kilo Company. They must be shooting at the North Vietnamese, because we thought that's where the mortar rounds were coming from, where we thought Kilo Company was. But then one round exploded about probably 40 or 50 yards from me, and I thought, oh, shit.
Hmm.
And then the next round landed right behind me and blew me about 8 or 9 feet forward, and I was knocked out, and then just for a few seconds, and then I woke up and I felt like my sacrum and my left side were being poked with a fucking branding iron, and I'd gotten hit. One of the other guys that was close to me, he was a little closer to the blast. He got the back of his head blown off.
Mm.
They must have hit us with 100 mortars there. And then when it lifted, it could have been 50, but it seemed like 100,
Yeah.
When it lifted, they came around and to see who was wounded. And Overholt, and again, it was dark, but he came over and found me and found this hole in my cartridge belt that was holding all my gear, and then found the wounds in my sacrum and stuff. You could just barely see. And then they started mortaring us again, but they made up a makeshift LZ away from our perimeter because the Gooch had us, they had our perimeter locked in.
Yeah.
With their mortars. So anyway, there was I had a guy under each under my arms, and I don't think I was on a poncho. I couldn't wear that thing in my sacrum. I think they put me on a poncho. But anyway, on our way out to the LZ, we passed this little tree where we were going to set our listening post up. There, and right underneath that tree was a huge mortar hole. So if he hadn't had to go and get a battery, if we'd have gone on out there, that mortar round would have landed right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And we'd all been killed.
Mm.
But anyway, they took me out to LZ, and they continued to get mortared. And my squad leader was out there. His name was Rod Consalvo, he stayed with me. Him and some other guys, security on the LZ, and when the helicopter came in, they dumped me. I was on a poncho. They dumped me on the deck of the helicopter, and this was again in the darkness there. And the helicopter took off and banked over and started heading back towards Dong Ha. And there was another guy. I think there was three or four of us on the helicopter, an old CH-34.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's boots kept kicking me in the head. When the helicopter banked, his feet would just come over against my head, and it hurt me to move away from it. So I said, "God damn, get your feet off me!" Of course, you can't hear it. It's so noisy and windy.
Right.
But anyway, when we got into Dong Ha, we were picked up by an ambulance out on the airfield, and they put me in. And the guy whose feet have been in my face the whole time, got put up on the upper rack, I think. And when they put me on, the corpsman on the ambulance said, "Don't look up there." And I said, "Well, of course, what are you going to do when somebody tells you don't look up? You look up there."
Of course.
And that was the guy next to me who I'd known, and I don't remember his name. He was a real quiet guy. We call him the silent one. He's the one who had the back of his head blown off.
Mm.
And I'm not sure how I knew that, but I knew it. And then they took me to Delta Med, threw me on the floor, and x-rayed me. Your x-ray table was the floor. They put an x-ray plate under you and brought a machine and x-rayed you. And I was in Delta Med with all the other wounded. And it was, it was a casualty receiving center with 3rd Medical Battalion. They put me on a gurney. I was really in a lot of pain, because I had the shrapnel in my chest and in my sacrum. Any movement I did was absolutely agonizing.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was laying on there just to, fuck, I was kind of scared, I guess. Glad to be out of the line of fire, but I was just laying there, and then a guy in jungle boots, he had a scrub shirt like the one I'm wearing right now. He had jungle boots, and he had a stethoscope slung over his neck like I wear, and it was a doctor, I guess, and he came and put a hand on my shoulder, and he said, "Don't worry, Marine, you're going to be all right." And that night I was, they took me out back out to the airfield, put me on another helicopter and flew me out to the repos where they operated on me that night. And I woke up the next morning in white sheets, and a round-eyed nurse was waking me up to take my vital signs and bring me a tray full of it was bacon, pancakes, eggs, and toast, orange juice, and coffee.
Wow. That must have been quite a treat. Were you able to eat any of it?
Huh?
I said that must have been quite a treat. Were you able to eat any of it?
It was culture shock is what it was, you know. it was like coming out of hell and going to heaven, mm-hmm. you know, except for hurting like hell.
Right.
But yeah, a couple of things, you know, I'm just coming out of surgery today. Well, how the fuck do you get into that? Well, my inspiration comes from the corpsman who took care of us in Vietnam. I told you about the corpsman who took care of the Vietnamese in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And took care of us when we were wounded, and then the doctor who came up to me, I had no idea what the fuck was going on, you know, I was scared to death. And he just real calmly and like he knew exactly what the fuck he was talking about. I said, "Don't worry, Marine, you're gonna be all right." You know? And those are the things I remembered when I was a oceanography major in college. And out in San Diego, and suddenly got the calling to do what I'm doing now.
Hmm. Now, how many pieces of shrapnel were in you, do you remember?
Two real big ones. One in my left chest, it went into a muscle called the latissimus dorsi.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was right in the sacrum. And then I had a bunch of smaller pieces all over my back that would either remain there. I have some still in my chest, I have still some in my sacrum. Some of them would remain, but a lot of them would be, the smaller pieces didn't go deep enough, they'd be spit out over the next few months.
Mm-hmm.
As the body rejects foreign bodies, you know.
Yeah. How long did your recovery take? How long were you on the repose?
Well, I got there Easter Sunday night, and I got back out to the field after, Easter Sunday was May 26th. I got back out to the field on the 1st of May. Might have gone out there earlier, but the ship needed to get resupplied and have some stuff done to it. So while I was a patient on the ship, it had to take unexpected for me. I know they planned it, but they had to go and spend 10 days in the Philippines at Subic Bay, which was the most exciting 10 days of my whole life.
Tell me about that time there.
Well, after about a week and a half or so, I was getting to where I could walk again. It was just a pain in my sacrum. They debrided my sacrum, my chest a couple more times, and I was on the repos and getting used to eating ice cream. But still, it wasn't like a holiday. You know, the Navy nurses and the corpsmen and the ship's company, they're pretty strict. You know, if you're a patient, you're going to act like a goddamn patient.
Sure.
And the nurse, she was a black lady, a lieutenant commander, and she had the absolute thickest Boston accent I've ever heard in my life. She was worse than the Kennedys. And boy, she was a naval officer. Don't you forget it. She would come into the head. You know, you weren't supposed to smoke in the head. You're supposed to smoke out on the rails. You know, she would come in, bust into the head. She said, "All right. All right, you patients, if you don't have your britches down around your ankles, put out those cigarettes, get the hell out of here, and get back to your rack. If you got your britches around your ankles," which is, we only had the scrub, you know, kind of pajama thing, Bob. "If you finish up and get the hell out of here and get back to your rack, you're a patient of mine." So, anyway, by the time we got to Subic Bay, I wasn't going to get liberty unless my sutures were out. You know, they sewn as much as they could back together, but they got these wire sutures out, and I remember we had the lecture, the safety lecture from Miss Lee, you know, for our ward there before we leave the ship. It was the typical, "Don't go out and get all fucked up, you know, and catch a bunch of gonorrhea from these whores and." don't be stupid asses, you know, like you're just 18 and 19 year old Marines, which is exactly what we were, you know. What the hell do you expect? And so they let us off the ship. We got to a little jeepney cabs to the gate, got out in town and hit the beach in Longapo on Magasete Drive. And Jesus Christ, we walked upstairs into a bar. It was several bars actually, but we walked up into one, and there was a girl on a clean up table. She wasn't one of the young little teeny bopper whores. She was a grown woman. She was 32 years old. Her name was Rosminda, and she wasn't one of the bar girls. But I kind of took a shine to her, and got her to go with me. We rented a hotel next door, hotel room, and she was a girlfriend for a few days. Then that. In one of the other bars right next door, there was another younger girl. I found out how young she actually was. I thought she was my age, around 17, 18, you know. But I started going with her. Her name was Lucy. They called her Juicy Lucy because she would chew juicy fruit gum and spit it on the floor. She was not very sophisticated. Anyway, I had those two. You know, time came for us to getting close for us to come back. We're still a few days away, and somehow I think I was with Lucy. Now, you know, once the Marines all hit the beach together, you know, stay together. But when we start to peel off with the different women, you know, we're liable to bust up. And you know, hey, we'll meet you back here later. You know,
right.
Everybody fine, you're on your own. And I was coming back to the to the gate. You know, I was getting it's probably around 11. Night. We had to, Cinderella Liberty, we had to be through the gate at midnight. And the Enterprise had docked, and the Enterprise crew had Liberty. And these guys were able to wear civilian clothes. Of course, the Marines, we were naked when we got on the ship. So in order to give us Liberty, they just gave us old khakis, Marine khakis. Everybody had Marine belt, Marine shoes, Marine hat, Marine khakis, you know. So no question, you're into a Marine.
Right.
So there's three guys walking past me, you know, and one of them is tall guy. He was a big mouthy guy. Started giving me shit, you know, and the other two guys were just kind of watching. And I don't know, it's just crazy, you know. After all I've been through there, and we were going to be sent back, and it dawned on me that hey, I could be fucking killed out here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was supposed to get sent back, so things changed for me a little bit. I really didn't give a shit, and so I told these guys, well, listen, you give me shit. Look, I had you know, the patient wristbands that you have in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I had one. Clearly, I was a patient, you know. So yeah, here, I just had my fucking ass blown out, but I'll take you three sons of bitches on, bring it on, motherfucker. And the other two guys, they were a little more sober. This is like, this is right, you know.
Hmm.
And the other guys, he was the one with the mouth. He says, yeah, okay, come on, motherfucker, I'll take you on. And so he put his fist up, you know, we danced around a little bit. Then he lashed out and he hit me right up in the head. And I say I don't know what happened, I don't know exactly what happened. My fist came all the way back from the fucking, I think from the jeepney parked 10 feet behind me and landed right in the middle of his fucking nose. And that guy, he bounced into a fucking, this big plate glass window of a little shop there. And I thought, oh shit, that thing's going to break, you know, but it didn't. But he went down, and then I just started wailing on the son of a bitch. I just started pounding him with my right hand, which broke. And all of a sudden, as I was pounding this guy, I got lifted right off my fucking feet up, and my feet were 12 inches off the fucking deck, and my arms were secured about as good as they could be secured by anybody. I looked right and left, and there was about a 250-pound sailor and a 250-pound Marine, both of them in white helmets. There was the Armed Forces Police. big son of a bitch. I think I weighed probably 140 pounds, you know. And these guys, all right, Marines, they're coming with us. They had the paddy wagon right there. I don't know how I missed it, you know. And so they threw me in the back of the paddy wagon. And I was all by myself. But they left. They left us. They pulled the lock on the outside. It wasn't a combination or key lock. It was just a latch that I couldn't reach because they had a cage there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they went on into another bar to arrest some other son of a bitch, you know. And there's a little kid out there. And I still had some cigarettes on, so I motioned the kid over. Hey, kid, come here. You want a cigarette? And the kid, yeah, Joe, give me a cigarette. I said, look, if you will reach up there and pull the latch on this thing and open this door, I'll give you 2 cigarettes. He said, okay, Joe, yeah, come on. And so the kid started working on the latch just as these guys were dragging some other drunk son of a bitch out of the bar. And they chased him off. And they threw me back up against the cab of the paddy wagon. And they threw a couple other drunks in there. And I found myself standing in a long line of perpetrators. Getting processed by the chief of police, you know, the armed forces police. And you know, everybody, if you can imagine a line, I mean, there must have been 20 drunks in this line. Had just been brought in by the police, and everybody had to go before this where the guy sat, and they had lines of armed forces police on each side. And can you imagine 20 drunks having to sit there with their mouths shut and quiet and stand in a parade dress? Oh, it's never going to happen. And so there were people getting the shit beat out of them. So finally, I went up there. They got my charges assembled and packed them up. And they gave it to the guard, and they put me back in another paddy wagon to drive me back to the ship from it. And all the charges against me, I guess, for, you know, drunk disorderly and assault and all this other stuff. Anyway, they sent me back to the ship, and I have to go through a captain's mast. Mm-hmm. Well, captain's mast on a hospital ship, come on, what the fuck?
Hey, for someone who might be listening to this, who's not familiar with what a captain's mast is, can you explain that?
Yeah, a captain's mast where you get in trouble. That's a disciplinary action. You know, if you're really bad, a lot of times, depending on what the degree of the offense is, you can be disciplined by the commanding officer of your unit or your ship, which in my case would have been the captain of the ship or the head medical officer or the chief of surgery. Who the fuck would that be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, and he would dole out your punishment. For example, a commanding officer could discipline one of his troops. He could, you know, dock him in pay. He could take a strike. Commanding officer could dole out that kind of punishment. So they sent me back to the ship, and they, you know, they turned over the my charges to the, I guess, to the quarter deck of the ship. But anyway, I was confined to the ship for 36 hours. The doctors confined me to the ship, and I never heard anything else about it. The only repercussion was that I did sustain a fracture of my index metacarpal, which is your trigger finger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the metacarpal is not the finger; it's the hand bone. I sustained a hairline fracture that in the fight, which was really really quite painful. But there's nothing, you know, nothing you can do about it. It's just nothing you can do.
Right.
So anyway, when after my 36 hours confinement, I got back out on the beach and said goodbye to Juicy Lucy and Los Mendez, that was the other one's name. And then we headed back to Vietnam, where we landed back in Da Nang, probably around the 1st of May. And they got me right on a bird and sent me back up to Dong Ha, where I joined back up with my battalion, got sent out to the field. With a brand new respect for the North Vietnamese, that's when things really started to turn the complete shit. You know?
Now, why do you say you have this brand new respect for the North Vietnamese?
Well, because I've seen, you know, I'd seen dead Marines. I'd carried dead Marines, and also not only was Pichon and Kelly were killed, and Erickson got blown up. Hell, our platoon guide, Sergeant, I forget what his name was. He was walking right behind me, you know, kind of running up, checking the lines, and I was down, you know, with my weapon pointed in the jungle, and he took a round right. He got gut shot right in the abdomen. And I ran into him on the hospital ship, and he was wearing a colostomy bag on the hospital ship.
Wow.
And he got sent back to the States, I think. But yeah, I had a brand new respect for the enemy, and I realized that this was no bullshit. That you're not 10 feet tall, bulletproof, and invisible. You're human, and when you get wounded, it hurts, and it fucks you up. And you know, this war is not a game, and it's not a television or movie. It's a real thing, and that was a very sobering experience.
Yeah.
And so it just got worse from there.
Tell me about the enemy. Tell me about the NVA. What the characteristics of them? What were they? How were they as fighters? Tell me about the enemy that you faced.
Well, the NVA, they were well trained, they were well led, and they were well equipped. Those three things, and they were very disciplined, and they were excellent soldiers, and not only that, they lived there, you know, and that had been their country. And things that we didn't find out until years later, I didn't. I told you what their commanding general said, General Giap. He said General Walt, Lieutenant General Lewis Walt, the Marine, he said he has 6,000 Marines stretched tighter than a bowstring to contain my 35,000 North Vietnamese. One of them was the 324B division. I know that. I learned this later doing research on it. You know, but they had highways and towns of tunnels underground that they would pop up from all the time. That, you know, we were aware that they had underground facilities, but we didn't have any idea the extent and the sophistication of the underground network that they had.
Yeah. So you come back, and this was, I guess you were wounded at the end or toward the end of March, and you're back here in the middle of May, so you're looking at about a month and a half, I guess, of recuperation from your wounds. Are you fully recovered?
No, I still, you know, my sacrum was sore. My trigger finger, it was so sore from the fight, you know, from that fracture, I had to use my middle finger for the trigger. The other really terrible, terrible, terrible thing that happened when I got back, they took our M14 away, and they had changed over to the M16, which did not work.
I know, looking at the questionnaire that you filled out for us, you have some things to say about the M16. So
yeah.
Take your time and take me through your experience with the M16.
Well, there's two things. There's my experience at the time, and then there's what I learned from my research later. About that, but at the time it was brand new, and it looked really awesome. You know, a little black thing. It weighed 7 pounds, or the M14 weighed 9 pounds, and it was shorter, easy to carry. It had bipods. It looked really cool, you know. But what you need a weapon to do is fire. So when they issued me this new weapon, when I was back in Don Holland, just arrived from the hospital ship, you had to take it out and fan fire. So I put a magazine in it. Fired off an automatic burst, and you know, put a magazine through it, put another magazine in the weapon, and it jammed after a couple rounds. I was like, well, that hell, you got a bad one. So they gave me another one, and another one, and another one. So finally, we went through three or four of them, and that was the thing that happened with each of them. You know, you get a couple of magazines through them, and it would jam. And what would happen is the empty cartridges would get stuck in the chamber, and they wouldn't extract. And so, in most cases, you'd have to extract the round by shoving a ramrod through the barrel and knocking it out. You know, So anyway, so look, you've gotten three bad ones here. Here's the last one we got here. Take that. That's bound to work. Take it and get on the helicopter and get back out to the field. You know.
Hmm.
And that was a very disconcerting feeling out there. But when I got back out to the you want to talk about the M16? That was it. In the other firefights that we're going to be having later on, it failed every time.
Mm-hmm.
But this time when we got back out to the field, when I got back out with my unit, I had clearly gotten PTSD. I mean, who wouldn't? Of course, PTSD wasn't a term we used. That didn't come into being as a diagnosis until 1980 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were clearly fucked up. I remember one time when I got on the hill, out by the rock pile. They'd had a little makeshift table area where, whenever they brought out these buckets full of hot chow from the rear. We'd sit out there at a little table and eat it in a kind of a little half bunker. And I'd gone out there to just get some of those beans or soup or whatever they had out for us. And afterwards, I just kind of woke up walking along the little path on the hill out there. Beautiful day, is nice green grass, clouds and everything. And I was just kind of walking along, and I was just suddenly was seized with the ice cold fear and the realization that, fuck, I'm empty handed. I don't have a fucking weapon.
Mm.
And where in the hell is my weapon? Which is absolute. That's the worst sin in the world for a Marine to commit. And fuck, So I had stopped. I couldn't even remember where I'd just been. I actually had to stop in my tracks and look forward, and then turn around exactly 100 degrees opposite. And start retracing my steps. And remember, I just went over here and had a plate full or a bowl or a cup full of this shit over there. And fortunately, it must not have been long, because I went back over there. My weapon was sitting. There was nobody there. My weapon was sitting right there.
Hmm.
And I was just, oh man, I was trembling. That's the scariest I've ever been in my life. What if somebody had caught me out there leaving my weapon on the hill somewhere?
Yeah.
But I just complete. Brain lapse, This was the time. This was April. This is just May, April, May of 67, and you probably know what was happening while I was on the repo that month. That was the month where elements of my battalion were fighting it out on Hill 881 and 861 over by Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we were hearing it at the time, but I did find out later, and the times get kind of mixed up. But a lot of the guys that were killed at Hill 881 and 861 were found with these M16 broken down right beside them, where they were trying to reduce the stoppage, and they couldn't produce the firepower that they needed to return fire to the huge numbers of North Vietnamese out there. Anyway, no confidence in this weapon, which I already fan-fired, and it hadn't satisfied me. And then to be back out there where I could be killed, and then to have my mind playing tricks on me like that, that was very, very disconcerting.
Yeah.
For about a week, a week and a half, a few more patrols, a couple of night ambushes. I got caught up with my old fire team leader, Donnie Johnson, who had to be medevaced before the Easter operation. They had a medevac, Donnie. He went. He also evidently had just terrible PTSD. He'd gotten word that a friend of his, who was in the Army, had been killed. They were best friends back home, and he just went absolutely berserk in the middle of the night, and he was hallucinating everything. And he was taken out of the field, sent back to the rear. I guess got some psych help. He must have been put on some drugs. Then they sent him back out to the field, and he was working the supply. And you could tell this guy had just undergone a psychological metamorphosis.
Yeah.
But he remembered me, and he fixed me up with gear and cans of this or that, from goodie boxes or USO packages and stuff from back in the rear. But he was clearly fucked up, you know.
Yeah. Well, what about you? Did you realize at the time that this was a psychological reaction to what you'd seen before?
I wasn't sophisticated enough to put it all together. I just knew that the thing that stood out for me was my new realization and appreciation that you know, I may not have long to live.
Yeah.
You know, because people come out here and they do die, and I've watched them die, and I've watched them get really fucked up. And you know, I just got here in I left home in December, and I'm supposed to be here till next January of 68. There's plenty of time for me to get killed.
Yeah.
In fact, one night we got intel again, for whatever that's worth, that there was a huge force of North Vietnamese that had their eye on us, and they wanted to attack us and overrun our little base camp out there. And the numbers were just going to be overwhelming, and we needed to get ready for that. And I thought, oh shit, you know. But there's nothing. What are you going to do about it? You can't. There's nothing you can do to change that, you know.
Right.
And you know, I was raised in Catholic school, and I just in fact the afternoon before that night, they flew a Catholic priest out there to hear confessions and do mass, and everybody to, you know, go to mass and go to communion. All the Catholics did, you know.
Right.
And after that was over, I was out there in the bunker. I said, "Well, you know, you're raised in a Catholic school, you think, well, hell, that's about as close as I can get to being able to die and not to have to spend too much time in hell before I go to heaven."
Right.
So fuck, there's nothing I can do about it anyway. So I just sat out there and enjoyed the sunset. And it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. Didn't realize it. But anyway, the attack that night never came.
Is this something that would happen periodically? Would you deal with a bout of this from time to time?
No, because things were about to change drastically within just a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
There was a battalion. I was in the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines.
Right.
There, Indy Company. There was a battalion that was been known all over Vietnam by not only the Marines, but every other branch of service. So the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, the
right.
name for that was the Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And people were getting killed. I mean, if we thought we had a bad 1-9, I mean, they were the hard luck battalion of the war, you know. And then one day, myself and the other guys from the December draft, Lee Amon, Tommy Allen, Jimmy Dugan, who else? Neil Aldrich. We'd all gone through the boot camp and the ITR dollar training. We traveled together. You know, we were in the same company, not the same platoon, the same squad, but we were all shipmates since training back in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
We all got gathered up. We were called the December draft because we, you know, left in December, the December draft 66, and everybody from the December draft 66 from 3-3 was being transferred to fill in all the holes in 1-9. So in just a matter of a half a day, hey, here's your new orders. You're going to 1-9. You know, get your shit and get on board the trucks. And they drove down Highway 9, past the rock pile, past Camp Carroll, and past Cam Lowe. And Delta Company 1-9 was dug in there. They were fixing to go on a patrol that night. And then an operation was going to kick off a day or two later. And I got to meet my new squad leader and some of the other guys there. And these guys were really fucked up. Just really fucked up. I mean, you could tell all of them had the 1,000-yard stare.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a few myself. I don't know. But everybody just was, they were kind of quiet. I mean, it looked like everybody was just seeing death somewhere out there not too far away, you know. And so that was around May
12th, 13th, or something like that. Then we got an op order to go on another operation again. We're chasing North Vietnamese up there, so we joined another operation. I think this is when Operation either Hickory Nut or Cimarron was kicking off, and we were part of it. Huge operation, Marines and some Army tanks and Arvin units supported by naval gunfire. Huge operation into the DMZ to capture, kill, chase the enemy, you know. And so we started out there. It's probably May 12th or 13th. And that's another big, so I don't know how much time you got, but that's another big one.
Well, please, let's... While we're on the topic, let's go ahead and discuss this.
Okay. Well, brand new squad, brand new platoon, and of course, my boys and I, we all got split up into different squads, different platoons and stuff. They made Jimmy Dugan a radio man. Lee Amon was in my platoon, but within another squad. Aldridge was in another squad, I believe. And Tommy Allen, he was a real jokester. He was in, I think he put in one of the other platoons. But I remember driving out there from 3-3 down Highway 9. Tommy kept us laughing because, I mean, this guy, everything he said was funny. It was a joke or something. He was a hilarious guy. But anyway, a couple of days later, we struck out and started stomping across the rice paddies and through the jungles up north and going through villages. Same experience, you know, when you go through the villages. Some of the Vietnamese gave us, you know, had water and they had, you know, things like that for us, invited us to, you know, to fill our canteens out of their water barrels and things like that. And we go deeper and deeper into the DMZ. And I remember one night, it was probably the 12th or 13th, maybe, Lee and I were in the same platoon. And we were out in the jungle, up there in the DMZ, where both of us knew we could get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I shared a hole with Lee, and I'll be goddamn if Lee didn't go to sleep on watch that night. I mean, everything was dark, you know, and I could just feel North Vietnamese wanting to sneak up and cut our throats, you know. I woke up and fucking Lee was snoring, you know. I said, Lee, what the fuck? You know, wake up, you asshole. But, you know, you're so tired anyway, you never sleep, you know, so. You can't really fault the guy for, you know, sitting in the dark. You can't smoke. You can't talk. You got to keep your eyes open and pitch black. You don't know when your eyes are closed or not, you know?
Yeah.
And so we got up the next morning. We crossed the stream. And then we emerged later in the afternoon. We emerged in a clearing. And something started to give me kind of the willies about this. And we came through a long, kind of a dog leg of a clearing and walked around through that. And then I saw a huge fucking Catholic church. And it was the same church that I'd been hit by. And I just, my blood pressure probably went through the roof. I started trembling. And they sat us down very close to where we had been dug in that night that we got boarded in 3-3.
Yeah.
And our company commander wanted to recon by fire. He set up a 60-millimeter mortar to start shooting into the north part of the jungle, see if he could chase some of the North Vietnamese toward us so we could cut them down. Didn't work. He walked the mortars all the way back into our position. One landed close to Lee, and he got a piece of it in his arm. He got medevac, which took, you know, that the whole thing probably took an hour, you know, to fuck around that. Then we saddled up and started moving out. Going back, almost retracing the steps that I had taken with 3-3 to come out, that little banana grove.
Mm-hmm.
We went through that, and as soon as we got right through that, we started taking fire. And, instinctively, Marines, when you hear fire, you know where it's coming from, you attack. So,
right.
Myself and a couple other guys from 3-3, who hadn't been with the Walking Dead but for a couple of days, we wanted to keep other guys, so we just started moving toward the fire. And I held my fire. I was going to start, you know, just popping off rounds because I didn't trust this M16. You know, but we started walking, and I told Graham, fuck, the guys from 1-9, they were down. They were down with their weapons pointed. They were going to find out what was going on first, you know. And with the rounds that were fired, several people had been hit. One of our corpsmen, he was in the other platoon, or he might have been with our platoon, but he was up with one of the other squads. He'd gotten hit and evidently captured by the North Vietnamese, and they killed him after they captured him.
Mm.
And then another guy, an M79, he was another guy that went off into the jungle and was going to look for something to shoot at. He got hit and was down, and it was just mass confusion. And we came around and gathered up a couple of guys from each squad, and we were going to go out and rescue this M79 man. And so I got with the other guys. We had one of the other squad leaders in the platoon lead us out there. And we went after, you know, 50 yards into the jungle where this guy was going to be. And we started taking fire, and we got behind a tree and returned fire. And sure enough, this damn M16 that I had, I got about two-thirds of a magazine through it, and it jammed.
Hmm.
And, you know, what are you going to do? You don't have time to break it down and get a ramrod out and go through the bore. So somebody else, there's another team out there looking for this guy, too, and they got him and pulled him back. And it wasn't until we got back where a company was already setting up a perimeter where I could break my weapon down and knock this cartridge out of the chamber. And that whole night, we traded fire, a lot of mortar fire and automatic weapons fire, and of course we called in artillery all around our position there. And we had some wounded. The helicopter came in the next day to take out, and so the helicopter, it was a CH-34, came in to take out our wounded. And they got some wounded on board, and then as soon as this guy took off and got about almost treetop level, North Vietnamese opened it up, and they got his tail rotor, and this thing started spinning. and it controlled crash almost on top of me, and the guys were up there on our line. But, you know, when a helicopter crashes, the tail rotor that can't stabilize the thing, so the main rotors keep going, and then the helicopter is spinning in big circles, you know, go, you know, two dozen times in big circles, and you think, my God, that thing's gonna run me over, you know. But it stopped, and they got everybody off, and they got the blades of this thing off, because the blades were going to interfere with any other helicopters coming in. They were probing our lines all night. We were exchanging artillery fire, mortar fire. More guys got wounded. We evacuated the wounded to the church, you know, around the church, and the dead started. They were stacked like cordwood over there by the church. And then I think it was the same day. We were trapped. The Delta Company. We were absolutely trapped. We were completely surrounded by at least a regiment of North Vietnamese.
Wow.
And we couldn't get out. You know. We had more wounded the next day, and I was assigned to carry one of the wounded and put him on the helicopter. And I don't think our perimeter from one side to the other in this little banana grove, I don't think it was 60 yards wide. It was pretty tight because there wasn't that many of us, and we couldn't get water. You know, that spring over by the church had water. We sent people over canteens, but they'd have to fill them up real fast because the North Vietnamese had that sighted in and would start shooting mortars over there. They knew people were going for water. So what we were doing for water, this little banana tree grove, it was just cutting chunks of the banana tree and chewing on that. And that's got plenty of water in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we were getting the water that day. Then later that day, I got tasked to go bring a wounded guy on the helicopter. And they brought a helicopter in, and the platoon CT was right by a big bomb crater, and that's where our LZ was. And so anyway, we were trying to put this guy on the helicopter. The helicopter is just about to come down. Maybe the wheels were 5 feet off the deck. And of course, you can imagine the wind being created by the prop blast there. Well, right about the time this guy's ready to land, the North Vietnamese opened up, And you see the crew chief with his hand reaching out to help grab a corner of the poncho. We're going to bring this guy on. But then, gunfire started erupting from everywhere. And I think if you could have heard it above the rotor noise, you would have heard these bullets strike the helicopter. And finally, the pilot, well, not finally, just real quick, he started taking that much fire. He brought in full power, and 5 feet off the deck is about as close as that guy got to the deck. And he was gone. And the fire continued, and the Marines started shooting back. The helicopter door gunners were opening up. The North Vietnamese were opening up. I was stuck there with this guy. The other guys on the other corner of the poncho, they got down. And I don't know where they went, but I was by close enough to this guy. I think I was by his head, and his hand was close to mine, and he grabbed my forearm on my wrist, and so I started pulling back toward this bomb crater, just probably 10 or 12 feet behind me, and pulling. But I had my bad hand, the one that was broken, and I was tugging on it. And I still had a shrapnel wound in my sacrum. I was doing my best just to try to pull him over the edge of that bomb crater so that he wouldn't get hit. Pull him down to the edge where he'd get his head over. And I couldn't pull anymore. And I pulled him so his head got down in the bomb crater. And I didn't have to rest. And so I just rested right there on top of his head. Try to protect him as I could. And after a few more seconds, the fire lifted. And they just brought him down into the crater, and the corpsman would take care of him down there, and so we could get another LZ set up somewhere.
Right.
And I'll get back to my hole. And we spent the rest of the night getting mortared, and then the next day, under another attack, North Vietnamese were coming in, and we were shooting, trading fire. Again, my weapon stops, and I actually had to drop on a cell. Well, I think it was a cell. It was just three soldiers, three North Vietnamese soldiers, and my weapon jammed again. And before I could say, "Oh shit!" I hurled a grenade, which landed not too far from my head, but I had my helmet on. And I was down in the hole we dug, and anyway, the one, again, knocked me out. But I was awake, and my left biceps was on fire, and I looked and had a hole in my shirt, and you could just imagine. Seems like, as I remember, the tissue fluids were just—they were boiling and steaming. I know they were, but that's what it felt like, So that's kind of how I remember it.
Yeah.
And this guy Davis, he was in my squad. He was in the hole with me. He was a black guy, real nice guy, But he'd been in 1-9, so he was bad ate up with PTSD. I tore my shirt open and my sleeve open and saw a big hole in my arm. Fortunately, it just missed the brachial artery, but it completely transected my biceps all the way down to the bone. And I said, "Shit!" I gave him my battle dress. I said, "Hey, man, wrap this thing, will you?" I said, "We got to get our weapons pointed downranger, And Davis just froze. He couldn't look at stuff like that. He couldn't do it. So I put one end of the thing in my teeth, and I wrapped it around. I dressed it myself, and Corman got to me later, and they tagged me for medevac, but we couldn't get medevacs in. And the company commander asked, "Hey, Doc, can these guys still fight?" And said, "Yeah." So they left me out there to still fight. And then later on, of course, the Marines aren't going to leave one company up there surrounded. So they, had other, I think, Bravo Company 1-9 and maybe Charlie were coming in to relieve us. So they were coming in from the southeast side, fighting their way through to us, and they did. They got us a bigger perimeter, and in the big field that we had surrounded, that's where they had the CH-47 or CH-46s landing. They were just barely. He preferred not to all the way land. He came down maybe a foot or two off the deck and lowered the back ramp. And when I got out, they were just taking walking wounds. He had to run out to the helicopter. They had no time for dragging guys on ponchos or stretchers. And so I ran out, and then as just as I got on, with a couple other walking wounded, there's another guy he was just barely able to walk. They didn't tell him to come out, but he was coming after the helicopter anyway, trying to get on. And so the pilot let the bird down, and the crew chief and a couple others just, you know, reached back and grabbed this guy by the shirt and brought him on board and got off just as they started mortaring again. And again, back at dawn, Delta men, and they operated on my arm that night and kept me overnight in Delta men.
How severe were your injuries?
This one just one. It went right through the biceps all the way, just about down to the bone. But it missed a major artery and a major nerve there.
So how long were you there at Dong Ha?
Well, I stayed at Delta Med. They admitted me overnight. They had debrided my arm, which made it, you know, chop some local anesthesia, wash it out, pick out the big pieces they could find, and then the next morning they re-explored it under local anesthesia, bandaged it, and decided to do what we very often do with war wounds, and that is to leave it open for a couple of days, and then so they released me back to my company area, and I think I came back a day or two later, and they debrided again, and then they sewed it up with these wire sutures that were used back then, and then sent me back to my company area in the rear. It's inside the wire at Dong Ha, Dong Ha was a big base, and each battalion has their own area back there. You know, you're out, you know, the working dogs, if when we're working dogs, we're out in the jungle, you know, doing operations, but we have a headquarters back in Dong Ha, that's where it was. So they, you know, every morning I had to go to sick call and get the dressing changed and then go to working parties, and usually they had me burning sugars. I had one good arm, and, you know, they had these 50-gallon steel barrels, and, you know, cut in half. Mm-hmm. No, shitters. Everybody knows what a shitter is.
Right.
Anyway, I'd have to go out there with one good arm and a 5-gallon can of diesel, and mix that with the shit and stir it with a big long stick and try to stay upwind of the smoke.
That must have been a pretty pleasant experience.
You know, it's so pleasant that even in Iraq in 2005 to 2008, when I got a chance to go out and help the troops burn shit, I'd always take my turn. And I've got pictures of myself. I never got pictures of myself burning shit in Vietnam, but I goddamn sure had them doing it up in near the Syrian border in Iraq. That's the only regret I have about Vietnam. I never got pictures of me burning shit. So anyway, I got sick of it. But one good thing about the rear in Dong Ha is there was an old farmer's hut that was right there in the middle of our company area, and they would allow us to have beer over there. And every night they had beer call, and you're supposedly limited to 2 beers, which is bullshit. You take a few piastres, and you can buy as much beer as you can drink, and, you know, not tell anybody about it. So people were over there getting shit-faced every afternoon, you know. And they'd even show movies outside at night. They'd put a screen up, and we'd get rocketed and mortared at night. They'd have shut down the movies, and they'd have to run in bunkers and shit, you know. But, you know, you weren't as likely to get killed there as you were out in the bush, you know. And as long as I had my arms all fucked up, they wouldn't send me back out to the bush.
Right.
But I got so sick of shit details and burning shit that one day the first sergeant, you know, first sergeant Rivers, great leader. He's a good guy. He's a real. I think he probably got first sergeant fairly young. He probably was mid-30s. He's a black guy, very educated, you know. But he made me burn the shit every day. He said, "Okay, I'll give you a choice, Doc Hammer." He says, "We need people to ride security on the convoys going up to Con Tien. Con Tien, you know, is the northernmost outpost. That's like a huge pit, standing right up there overlooking the Dien Hai River. And that was a fire base up there, but it was a perfect aiming point for the North Vietnamese. It was on a continuous rocket mortar fire. I said, fuck, I'm so tired of burning shit. Fuck it. I'll ride on the convoy." So you ride on the convoys, you sit in a bunch of among a bunch of ammo boxes and sea ration crates, and you point your weapon over the sides of the fucking 2.5-ton truck. We call it a deuce and a half, or a 6x, as Marines call it. And you ride on this this bumpy road. You have to go like 2 or 3 miles an hour over some of the areas, you know, across streams and everything. You know, if you leave Camelo, and I think it was probably 11 miles or something up. Something like that, I'm guessing. I could look at a map and tell you. We take it up to Conkey Inn. And, of course, as soon as we got there, we'd have to run off into a bunker while the guys unloaded the thing. I just had one arm. So I'd go to the bunker while you unloaded. And sometimes we would have to stay out there until the fire would lift and get back aboard our trucks and drive back to Don Ha, hopefully in time for beer call. You know.
Right.
So,
and how long were you doing these convoys?
How long of what now?
How long were you taking part in these convoys?
Well, I got wounded on May 15th, which was Mother's Day, by the way. That's hard to remember this shit so well. and the wound that they showed in my arm, they leave the stitches in probably 7 days, so. Probably 10 to 8 days after I got wounded, so that would be the 25th. They took the 25th and 26th. They took the stitches out of my arm, and before an hour or two had passed, the wound came apart again. It opened up a dehis, so I had to stay there, continue to get open wound care for another week before they tried to sew it again. So probably looking into the 1st of June there, and after that, I was riding convoys, burning shit. And getting shit-faced at night, watching movies and ducking rockets in Don Ha. And one night we got attacked with tear gas. And it was people fucking around. One of the staff sergeants, I told you about the beer call, everybody gets shit-faced.
Right.
Well, I was sleeping in one of these tents, just surrounded by sandbags. And all of a sudden, at night, probably about 11 o'clock, I woke up like tear gas. You're gassing, you can't fucking breathe, your throat's on fire, your nose is running, your eyes are burning. And I thought, oh shit, the North Vietnamese got through the wire, they're attacking us with tear gas. I'm about to get a bayonet through my fucking chest, oh fuck. No, it was some drunk asshole fucking around with a tear gas grenade, and he dropped it. Right outside our fucking chest, so the gas, we had the flash rays on all the sides, it was fucking hot,
Right.
And the gas drifted right through. But he didn't get in trouble. People would get in trouble for that shit back then. Now you'd be executed. But it was probably until the middle of June. Maybe almost a month.
Yeah.
During the day when we weren't burning shit, weren't riding convoys, we have knife throwing contests and stuff. Learned to throw a knife pretty well.
Yeah.
And a dagger. Or a K-bar or a bayonet, And then finally, I got well enough for me to rejoin the platoon. And that was another world of shit.
Now you were twice wounded here, and you're going back again. What do you think about going back out there again? You're no longer full of piss and vinegar like you said before.
I resigned to whatever my fate was going to be. I should have. I feel completely wired and fucked up. I was just 18-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
Marines only have one way to go, and that's forward.
Right.
That's where people tell you that's forward. You go that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I joined the rejoined the company. They were standing the lines up at Conti Inn, so we were in the constant rocket fire. So I got together with the Arvin, shared a hole with her. I think I was on a shit detail unloading convoys or something like that. And some of the Arvins were cooking chow, and they invited me over to sample some of this stuff with Nook Mom, which is why I still order it today.
Mm-hmm.
I go to a new restaurant. But they put fish heads and some of the hottest goddamn pepper I ever had in my life. And I thought these guys were trying to fucking kill me. But I remember that, and then just getting down in the bunker. As soon as you're getting up on top of the bunker, trying to enjoy the view, looking down the hill of Kantian across into North Vietnam. You know, things start blowing up all around you. You crawl down the marker, and people, you know, a few people get killed, you know, every couple of hours. And then we started operating, and we got one operation out of there, and that was the last one for me. We were going to do a sweep in the DMZ just north of what we call the McNamara Line, or we called it the Strip back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was a defoliated strip between Jilin and Kantian, and it was a bare area. And I think it was the Seabees or the Marine Engineers that put up these timber towers on the south side so they could keep a good watch on it, you know, with illumination. You know, you could see it at night. It'd make it hard for anybody to cross that thing without being seen.
Yeah.
And to be operating on the north side of it in the jungle between the strip and the Bien Hai River, which was pretty close. And I had no idea at the time how many thousands of tunnels and thousands of North Vietnamese there were up there. But we were on an operation probably a couple of days. We, you know, it was pretty common to have, you know, burst machine gun fire go right by your head and not know where it was coming from. And these guys could appear and disappear. That was a real bad. That was my last couple of days were coming up there. Well, the last couple of days in the field. I don't know how much time you have.
Well, we're probably at our limit for today, so why don't we go ahead and stop there. This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Dr. John Del Cambry. Today is 30 April 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Dr. Del Cambry is joining me by phone again from Odessa, Texas. Okay, Dr. Del Cambry, last time we left off, which was yesterday, you're going through the these episodes where you had wounded, and you, of course, were wounded three times there in Vietnam, and you're getting ready to go through the third time that this happened. So I wonder if you could take me through the lead-up to this, what the mission was that you were on, the whole setup for that, as well as this particular episode.
Yeah, well, this was in June of 1967, and by that time it was just a continuous string of operations, company and battalion-sized operations, as I recall, in the DMZ. And that was to flush out and find, fix, and annihilate the North Vietnamese. We were manning the lines up at Kantian, and our operation was to leave Kantian and go in an operation that would sweep the jungle north of the strip that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And as we got out of Kantian and got into the jungle, and the, you know, jungle interspersed with rice paddies and so forth, we would take intermittent fire from these guys. They would pop up and disappear just about at will, and they would fire mortars at us, and we had a difficult time finding them. I suspect that was because of the very sophisticated and broad network of underground tunnels that they had. Plus, they had the liberty of going back and forth across the Bien Hai River, which is the border of North and South Vietnam. I think we've been out maybe 3 or 4 days, I was sitting down as we were taking a break, and I had a burst of about 5 rounds of machine gun fire went right by my head, and of course that got my attention. And
sure.
Of course, by this time, I talked about how the guys in 1-9 all were different Marines. They all had the 1,000-yard stare, and everybody was very jumpy, and it was just a different outfit. It's the kind of it was kind of psyche that you would expect from people who had lost a lot of their friends, and who were constantly under assault like that, and at risk of being killed. We weren't able to find anybody who fired those rounds. And obviously, they could have come from anywhere from 30 or 40 yards away to 100 yards away. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So we got up and we continued sweeping the jungle, And we set in at night in around an old rice paddy. That's just bare ground where they used to grow rice, and it's surrounded by dikes that you know that grew foliage, including bamboo and some leafy types of foliage. Anyway, we would dig our holes maybe 30 yards from the dike, so that we'd have an open field of fire. I'm not sure why they didn't put us right inside the tree line that night, but they didn't. Some of our guys were right inside the tree line, and anyway, we sat in and started our two-hour watches, and I was manning a hole with another guy in my squad. I don't remember his name. He was a black guy. He was he was a pretty good Marine, and he'd been in 1-9. He was one of the guys that you know had his feet well on the ground, and you know had been in 1-9. He knew the jungle, and he knew how to be careful and everything. He was a good man to be with. But anyway, in the middle of the night, we got word that our listening post that we sent out that neither here nor I were on. The listening post goes out to, you know, maybe 100 or 200 yards. In that particular case, of course, you know, they can be as close as 30 or 40 yards as we were going to be the night that I got wounded the first time. But these guys may have been out maybe 100 yards, and they sat in the tree line in one of these dikes, and all of a sudden in the middle of the night they realized it because of a lot of noise and activity going on around them and right underneath them that they had set in right on top of a North Vietnamese bunker.
Mm.
And of course this had to be connected to this lattice work of tunnels, and so they were just given very, very quiet whispered sit rest, which is situation reports through the night. And of course everybody on the lines was awake and alert, I think, although we were still trying to take our sleep as we could get it, you know, but it was something very concerning to us. And we kind of poised ourselves with the amount of activity that they were describing there. We were poised to get an attack that night. Of course, we're out in the jungle. We don't have the concertina wire or anything. All we've got is a ring of foxholes in the company area and overlapping fire. And through the night, these guys survived. They never got discovered, and they started to leave the position a little bit before dawn. I remember I had a dream that it woke me up, it woke me up. I was actually, and I remember the dream very well. I was calling out. I was raising my voice for the guy in my hole, you know, kicked me, and he said, hey, wake up, man. He said, you're making noise. And I said, oh, shit, you know. So, you know, it was just starting to get barely daylight, you know, it's still a little bit dark out there. And we knew the listening post was coming in. We didn't know how long it would take them. And I was facing east toward the South China Sea, because that's where that's where the sky was the brightest. That's where the sun was starting to come up. And it just as the sun broke over the horizon, I saw the silhouette of a guy walk right from one side to the other, and he was followed by another guy. I said, "Well, shit, those guys are finally back." You know, the listening post. And so I told him, yeah, the listening post is back. And of course, they would have had the radio, and I didn't have to pass the word or anything. And the sun came up, and maybe another 20 minutes went by. And right from that tree line where I saw the silhouette of the guy, there was a single rifle shot hit one of our Marines three holes down. And it was killed him, by the way. It went right in his chest, it said. And so that got our attention. We poised on the edges of our holes with weapons. And then a couple minutes later, after that shot happened, we saw some silhouettes again, but this time it was light. And these were the foliage camouflage pith helmets that the North Vietnamese wore, and there was at least a cell, five of them scrambling around just in front of our hole there. And I would have thought they could have seen us, but I don't know, maybe they were, they knew where this other guy was, maybe, I don't know, but they were crouched and moving around, maybe they were getting ready to attack. And
how close were they?
Say again?
How close were they?
They were probably no further away than 20 to 30 yards.
Hmm.
They were pretty close. And he kicked me. He was kind of close. He said, he pointed out, he says, "Gooks, man." I remember it. And I saw that and I said, "Holy shit." And so I had my, I flipped my my safety off and just started opening up on it. And he did, and the guys in the hole next to him, I bet we put in 50 or 60 rounds right into those guys before all of them, with my weapon jammed. I don't know if theirs was jammed or not, you know. Mm. I got most of a magazine out of my weapon, and it jammed, of course. And and that was it, you know. They started to, you know, trying to decide what we were going to do and which way we were going to move that day because of the information we gathered overnight. So we must have been there another hour, and then somebody reported that a trench line, what they called a trench line full of gooks, over on the east side where a lot of this activity had been. And they started opening up on that with their M60 machine gun, and they wanted a spot to attack that. And I had just gotten that frozen casing out of my receiver, cleaned my weapon, you know, brushed it out, and ran the bore and dusted off all the rounds of the magazines I could get, you know. And they were coming up, getting guys to form a squad and attack that. Well, you don't really have to form a squad. You've got squads right there. Mm-hmm. And all they did was have other squads come over and fill our holes. They picked our squads, and I just went, "Oh shit," you know, because this was going to be a squad assault. You know, fire team rushes,
yeah,
on a trench line full of goose. And I kind of quietly lost it there. And there comes a time, you know, that you just resign yourself. You know, we cling so desperately to life and do everything we can instinctively to survive. But you just, the grip that you have on life just becomes exhausting. And it was starting about then, for until this attack was over, that I just really, I couldn't hold any longer. I just let go and just resigned myself with this. This is it, you know. Everything has been pointing to me getting killed out here. And, you know, everybody else too, but so you start to focus on yourself. So this is it. Well, fuck, you know, I wish this wasn't us, but, you know, who knows how long we're going to be out here. And this is 1-9 where people get killed, and maybe this is it. And fuck, there's nothing I can do. Absolutely not a goddamn thing I can do. About so just do what they say and move out, you know. And so they got us to move out, and we were trying to kind of sneaky peeing it one hole at a time, moving down to the south side of our perimeter that we dug in. And of course I had to go two holes over, and I jumped in the hole with this guy and looked like he was asleep, you know. And I said, "Excuse me," you know, because I hit his legs on coming in. I said, sorry about that. And you know, I kind of crouched down and moved, and didn't move his legs. You know, and I was looking out, you know, toward the jungle there, and he didn't move. You know, so shit was kind of crowded. There's plenty of room. You know, I thought he'd move his legs over. Then I looked around at him, and the guy was just as still as he could be, and his flak jacket was open. And he had a little tiny dark hole right in his chest, and I realized that was the guy that got shot.
Yeah.
By that round. And I just said, "Oh fuck," and I'm sharing a foxhole with a corpse for about another minute. And they says, "Okay, let's move out," you know. And so they moved us out. Our squad leader moved us out, and then we lined up at the edge of this long open rice paddy, just behind a little dike. And when we said go, we ran out and made a line and got down in firing positions, and probably 60 yards away was another dike, and the trench line of Duke's was supposed to be on the other side of that. And so we got out online and started firing just one or two bullets at a time. We didn't want to burn up a lot of ammo because, number one, we didn't want to run out of ammo, but more likely, we didn't want to put so many rounds through our weapons that they would jam.
Right.
And so we started doing the old classic fire team rushes, you know. The first and third fire teams lay down fire while the second fire team rushes. Maybe 15, 20 yards, they hit the deck, they lay down fire for the other two. It's kind of leapfrogging, you know, mm-hmm. online. And I had my weapon on automatic. And, God, when I was running, I tripped, and I was fine. And one of my rounds hit probably 3 feet away from one of the guys in my squad. His name was Jackson. And he said, God damn, Del Cameron. I said, shit, I'm sorry. You know, fuck. You know, because we're all trying to concentrate on this trench line. And the machine gun was firing not over our heads, but alongside of us, trying to create some suppressive fire while we were rushing. And anyway, we did the fire team rushes for maybe 60 yards or so. And it just so happened that my fire team, the three of us, got up to the dike first. And I was up front. And I got over the dike, and I couldn't see because the foliage was too high. I just sprayed a couple of times. And then the squad leader yelled at me. He said, Cameron, he said, throw a grenade over there. I took a grenade out, lobbed it over the other side, and it exploded. And then he says, okay, now go over on the other side of that dike and check it out. He tells me, you know, and I thought, oh, shit, you know, because this was supposed to be a trench line. I could just imagine me running in and dropping over into the middle of a trench line with Dukes on each side of me.
Right.
And I mean, but this is a firefight. You don't have time to say, hey, this doesn't make sense. You just fucking do it, you know. And so I rolled over the dike and down the other side, and there was no trench line there. It was just thick grass, thick grass, no trench line at all. But you know, whereas there had been no grass on the other side, flat ground, this was tall grass. And I looked around, and oh, sorry, this guy's doing it, And I was going to go back over this, but I started looking around, and there was I could see part of an arm sticking out, and it was clearly wasn't moving. The guy was dead, and I suppose that could have been one of the ones I got when I you know, when I leaned over the dike and sprayed a few rounds, and so I just sat there for a second and realized, well, fuck, this isn't a trench. This is a bunch of tall grass, and we could be goofs, you know, every square yard of this son of a bitch.
How tall was this grass? Do you remember?
How far what?
How tall was the grass?
How far was what now?
How tall was the grass that you were?
Grass?
Yeah.
It was probably 3 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 3 feet. It wasn't a huge, you know, 12-foot elephant grass. It was probably 3 feet tall, and it was mostly grass and foliage. And so after I saw this arm and saw enough grass to hide plenty of goofs, and that must have been what they were talking about, I rolled back to the other over the rice paddy dike, and it's not like this was a great big huge dike. I mean, this thing was probably 4 feet tall and maybe 10 feet wide,
mm-hmm.
with a little bit of foliage on the top of it, you know. And so I rolled back over, and I told him, I said, that's not a trench line. It's just a flat field full of grass. I don't know how many goofs are over there. And this is where it gets a little cloudy. We had to get up on the trench or on the dike and open fire. And I got about two more rounds in my weapon jammed. And you know, who's surprised about that? I think a couple other guys had their weapons jammed too. And about that time, somebody yelled grenade, and there was a grenade coming over the dike between me and another guy, a little closer to me. And it landed closer to me, and it exploded. And the next thing I knew, and the guys kind of helped me put this together. But next thing I knew, I got tackled and thrown down to the ground. And the guy was yelling at me, because evidently I was just kind of staggering around, standing straight up and staggering around. And I remember some other guys, other Marines were passing us, going past us. That was another squad come up to relieve us because, you know, our weapons had jammed, you know. But I got thrown to the ground and held down like a, you know, like in a wrestling match or something, you know. And it was a corpsman screaming at me, you know. And I had a concussion. I ruptured an eardrum and had a bunch of little pieces of shrapnel all over the left side. Nothing big. And he held me down. And you know, it didn't take long before I regained my senses. And you know, I was off balance. The other thing, because my eardrum was busted. And I felt a lot of scratching in the back of my throat, and I was coughing and shit like that. But that was it. He held me down and looked, you know, over my legs and arms, and saw some stuff that didn't amount to a whole lot. But it was a little piece of shrapnel in the skin, scratches and stuff like that. But they had me just lay down there in this hole. And things were a little bit cloudy for the, you know, because that was still in the morning. And for the rest of the morning, I know that they were starting to do some sweeps out there where we had attacked, and they sent another squad up there, and they started recon by fire, dropping mortars in, and then calling in airstrikes all over the place. Part of our platoon was going to be sweeping outside of our perimeter there after the artillery barrage let up. And I think they called in airstrikes, too. But, I stole it out of it. So they gave me a radio, just to hear, man, the radio, because I had a good ear on my right side. I mean, this is how desperate 1-9 was.
Yeah.
And they put me in a crater. It's an old bomb crater. And just to stick my head up above the crater and, you know, report anything that I saw. And during the lull in the action there, where there was no shooting or anything, we could hear entrenching tools digging in maybe 100 yards away to the north. They were just digging to be hell. And we were the only company out there. There were no other companies, no other Marines on that street. So that was the North Vietnamese digging in or doing something. They were building something, digging something. I don't know, they might have been digging mortar pits if they didn't have them already. But we were taking intermittent mortar fire from them, but we probably not as much as we would have if they hadn't been calling in artillery and airstrikes all around us all morning. So they asked me if I was okay. The corpsman could tell, you know, he saw a little blood in my ear and knew the eardrum was busted. But I could walk. I was ambulatory, and so they weren't. For the people that were killed, I think they brought in helicopters again. I don't remember after that. But I know that I walked out. We started moving out. We went toward the south, and by the end of the day, we were down at the strip. You know, that big wide barrier between GLN and Contien.
Mm-hmm.
They call it McNamara line, I think.
Right.
They called it the press. Anyway, we emerged on that, and I think we spent another night out in the field. By the next morning, we arrived back in Contien, and they took me to the BAS up there at Contien, and I picked a little shrapnel out of my skin, which was nothing, you know. But the doctor up there looked at my eardrum, and it was busted, and so they evac me on a truck convoy and sent me back to Donahoe. I don't think I realized until the next day Corbin rode me up for Purple Heart. And I was, well, shit, you know, okay. And that was three Purple Hearts. And once you get three Purple Hearts, you know, that's all Marines allow you. That they were going to give me orders to leave Vietnam, and I think it was by, this happened on the 29th of June. And so they had a flight for me out of Vietnam by, I think, July 2nd or 3rd.
Hmm.
And but on my last night in Vietnam, they needed, I was back in Dong Hau, but they needed people to man the lines on the perimeter of Dong Hau. And I got selected to do that. And so I made damn sure that like a lot of us had, you know, a lot of Marines, you know, we were issued M16s, but you either got your hands on a 45 with ammo, or you went to the PX and bought a 357 Magnum, a 38 or 22, something that you could use to shoot back, because absolutely nobody had any confidence in the M16.
Right.
And when I could get one, you know, we traded off 45s out in the jungle. But anyway, that night I took an M16 out, but I also had a 45. And that night, the Arvin compound, about a half a mile away, just started shooting up everything like hell. I don't know if they were being attacked or what, or if they were just spam firing their weapons, but they were just all kinds of fire going on over there. So I never slept. I stayed awake all night with a 45. My M16, I just left it there. Mm-hmm. I just had a 45 pointed out in the concertina. And
did you know that this was going to be your last night?
I didn't know when my flight was going to be. It turned out to be the last night. But I'm not sure if I knew whether that was the day I was going to leave or not. I know they put in orders for me. And then the next day, you know, I got my gear, went out to the airstrip, and got on board a plane. Just as the plane was taxiing down the runway, with myself and a few other Marines, some of them were going on R&R, some of them were leaving. There's even a Vietnamese woman in one of their traditional dresses, a big conical hat. She was on this plane going to Da Nang. Just as we were taxiing to their takeoff position, the base got hit again. We were going to get rocketed.
Hmm.
And anyway, we took off, and you know, everybody was kind of crouched down. For all the good we do, everybody was crouched down below the cargo net seats, you know, on the plane.
Right.
Taxiing and taking off. But then we got out over Dong Hau and over the beach and turned south over the South China Sea toward Da Nang. And reached Da Nang, you know, probably an hour flight or something like that. Got herded out, got put in a sea hut. You know, it's a regular hut with open windows, and some of them had air conditioning. They all had bunks and stuff, and they had showers there. And so I just threw my shit down and checked in, and went and got in the shower. In the shower, there was a Vietnamese woman there doing laundry, and that's where they did laundry. They used our bathrooms and everything there, and they would use our showers to wash the Marines' clothes, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, "Oh, fuck it," you know. I showered and went back to the hooch, and went. I took a nap for a couple hours, and then that night went over to the MAG 11, Marine Air Group 11, that's a helicopter squad. Their club with some other Marines, and we just we got drunk. And next morning, I don't think I was in Da Nang more than a day or two.
Yeah.
Next morning, I got put on a plane and flew out to Okinawa, and that was it.
What was it like for you to finally leave Vietnam? You knew this was coming. You had a couple of days worth of notice, or a few more days. What was it like for you to leave?
Well, I remember when I landed in Da Nang. Oh my God, the air transit facility was really busy. It was really crowded, and crowded with guys in khaki uniforms. You had to travel in khakis going back and forth from R&R, and there was Red Cross. People, there was Americans there, you know, civilian Americans. There was American girls there working for the Red Cross, and they, you know, the signs, they, you know, get dental checks before you leave country, you know, or by a trench mouth or have rotten teeth or something like that. And I think I went over to the dental thing, got my teeth checked out, and I couldn't believe that I was in a place that was safe enough to have American civilian Red Cross workers there, you know.
Yeah.
And so I just, and when I was in the shower, I just ignored that Vietnamese over there washing clothes, he ignored me. And I just, it dawned on me, so fuck me, I'm going to live after all, you know. And I just couldn't get over it. I thought, like, shit, no matter whatever else happens, I said, nothing else will ever be bad.
I'll be damned.
I'm going to survive this shit.
Hmm.
You know?
Wow, that's just absolutely incredible, especially after you've resigned yourself just a few days before that, you know, this is probably it, to be able to realize.
That's a real metamorphosis in psychology.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard other people.
Life and the pardon maybe when you're on death row.
I've heard other people talk about that, but what kind of effect does that have on you emotionally, psychologically, or shoot, even physically, to realize, all right, this is a complete and total change from what I thought? I mean, most people can't relate to something like that. How does that affect you?
Well, you celebrate. You know, I thought, man, for the rest of my life, I'll always do everything good. I'll never be bad, and I'll always be thankful. And shit, I'm gonna live. I'm gonna celebrate. You know, staying alive for the rest of my life. Well, that lasted about 3 days. I was in Okinawa, and I was hitting every fucking horror or house and bar on the fucking strip. I mean, Okinawa was fucking crazy. They put me in a security platoon there. And I actually got ordered. One of my first nights on watch there, security on the base in Okinawa, I think it was Camp Hansen or something like that. My job was to, they armed me with a 12-gauge riot gun. And my job was to guard the motor pool, which was right across the street. From the chief of the staff of the non-commissioned officers club, you know, mm-hmm. where Navy chiefs and Marine gunnery sergeants and up enlisted would go there and get drunk and stuff like that. And it was surrounded by a cyclone fence, and my orders were to keep everybody out. And if you have some drunk coming over the fence or something, shortcut through the motor pool on his way back to there, stop him. And then warn them three times, fire a warning shot, and if that doesn't stop them, level your weapon right there, center mass, and blow them away.
Hmm.
I mean, that was the order.
Wow.
Okay, right, yeah. And so I just sat out there all night and smoked cigarettes and just said, oh, fuck you,
Yeah, those orders must have seemed pretty ridiculous for you.
It was stupid, yeah, but everything was crazy in Okinawa. I mean, Marines back in the barracks were just going absolutely crazy. They'd hook up with a whore out in town, and they'd want to marry them after they fucked them twice, and there'd be somebody else in the barracks say, "Oh, you son of a bitch, you're fucking my whore," and these guys would try to kill each other. Somebody else would jump in and beat the shit out of one of them. Somebody beat the shit out of them, try to snap them back into reality. I mean, it was absolute bedlam, and they had the brig there. And the brig guards, one of my old buddies from back in training, he was a brig guard. And the brig guards just, I mean, that was they tortured people in the brig in Okinawa. And, the military police were just, they were just horrendous. And it was a fucking madhouse. And thank Christ that after I was there for about a week, they came to me and said, "Hey, listen, if you're willing to extend your tour in Westpac by another month, we'll transfer you out of here. Here's three places you can go. One was Sasebo, Japan. Another was somewhere else in the Orient. The third place was Sangley Point in the Philippines." And so I just fell out my dream shit. I think I want to go to Sasebo, Japan first. Anyway, I ended up getting the Philippines. I was flown out of there after about a week and a half and landed at Sangley Point in the Philippines, where I joined the Marine Barracks at the Naval Air Station there. And I was there for the rest of my tour.
Hmm. And how long did you have to extend again?
Just a month. I was due to rotate back to the States in January of 1968.
Right.
And I had to stay till February, which, fuck, fine. I wanted to stay in the Philippines for the rest of my tour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hell, I was 18 years old. I could drink. You know, I lived out in town. I had a girlfriend. I love the Philippines. I love the Philippine people. In fact, my wife is half Filipino.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, what do you do during this time that you're going to stay in the Philippines?
Oh, shit. Well, I continue to drink and fight and get in trouble. But one thing I learned in military school as a kid is how to do shit and not get caught every time. But we got called in the car for this. Sometimes some things you just can't help. Me and two black guys, so we were drunk, riding a jeepney through town, and I was perfectly happy to sit in a jeepney drunk as it drove me out the house so I could see my girlfriend. When somebody yelled some shit at us, it was a naval base, and so there were some sailors yelled that. You know, that we were all Marine Guard; they might have recognized me. And so the Jeter and Williams, these were two white guys. Hey, stop this motherfucker! Come on, Del Camry. No, I said, no, I could barely stand up. And so these guys lined up three or four sailors from some squadron, and I thought, oh fuck, you know what, you asshole! As you would imagine, the first punch that was thrown, the guy with a whiskey bottle in his hand came up right upside my head, and I wasn't even in shit, you know. And then Jeter and Williams just started wailing on these guys, and I bounced off the jeepney that he knocked me up against, and I caught this guy about at the belt line, just tackling. I sprang off the jeepney. When you get hit upside the head with a whiskey bottle, it's either going to knock you out or it's going to sober you up. It went back and hit the swinging door, inside, built into the inside of a club that you stepped down on. And goddamn, if we didn't go right through that fucking door, right into a table full of drunk sailors and their dates, and crashed into it, rolled around the floor, just wailing and shit. As we rolled off the table, fortunately, because this guy was bigger than me, I ended up on top. That whiskey bottle that he had in his hand, thank God that he had drank at least half of that son of a bitch before he hit me with it, you know. So I was holding his face down with one hand and just pounding the shit out of him with the other. Well, I made the mistake of getting my little finger caught in his mouth, and he clamped down on it, bit my finger. It was true. Then the sailors that were in the bar, they regrouped on the other side of the bar, and they start throw bottles and everything at us. Jeter pops through the door, starts throwing bottles and chairs back at these guys, and he yells at me, "Come on, Del, come on, Del." I said, "Well, fuck the guy, look." And the guy had my finger clenching his teeth, and so Jeter just he kicked him in the side or in the ribs or in the neck, fuck, I don't know. And the guy spit my finger out, and I got up, and Jeter threw me out the door. Remember I told you that the door opened in?
Right.
Okay. Well, Jeter threw me out of the street, and these guys, we're just starting to come. This must have lasted 20 seconds, maybe no more than that. They started to chase us out. You know, Jeter threw a chair, and then he pulled the door closed. All these guys chasing us. We're piled up against each other against the closed door. We all have. My finger was all fucked up. You know, I had a little mouse on the side of my head where it was pushed up. My finger was, it was just bare meat. And so I was staggering around drunk, trying to find my way back to my girlfriend's house. And I got picked up by the Armed Forces Police. The other guys got picked up. We got brought in. And the next day, we were doing the hog shit shuffle in front of the XO's desk. I recall it was one of the worst ass chewings I ever had in my life. But they couldn't really pin on us because we didn't start the fight, you know. And they couldn't prove, but there was the bar owner was just, he was livid about all the damage that we caused to his bar and all the
stuff. Sure.
But that was it. That was pretty much the story of my existence in the Philippines from probably late July up until I rotated in February the next year. And I had a girlfriend and I was going to get married. I was going to stay. I was even thinking of going to AWOL to stay in the Philippines.
Really?
In fact, in fact, when I got back to the States, I was contemplating giving the Marine Corps another couple of years if they'd let me spend a few more months back in the Philippines.
Hmm.
And I realized that would probably mean that I'd do another stand in Nam and get killed. But that's how fucked up and crazy I was. That was my plan, coming back to the United States. But when I got back to Camp Pendleton after 2 weeks at home with that in mind, me and my girlfriend, we rode each other just every day. But then I got back to Camp Pendleton, and that that all changed drastically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if you can recall this during the time that you're in the Philippines. Of course, the Tet Offensive kicks off late January and early February of 1968. What do you remember hearing, if anything, about what was going on?
Oh, we knew everything. We knew everything that was going on. You know, the Tet Offensive. You know, the well, that's not the only thing that happened either. That's not the only thing that happened. The Tet Offensive and the siege of
Quezon, of course,
of Quezon. Marines were locked in on that ship. I felt fairly confident, you know, and we were all worried, you know, shit, we could be sent right back into some shit. But there's one other thing that happened that nobody remembers. We had a ship, the Pueblo.
Mm-hmm. Right.
American ship that was off the coast of North Korea, and that ship got canceled, or got captured.
Mm-hmm.
The ship and crew, remember that?
Yes.
And so it was pretty clear that if you leave Vietnam with three Purple Hearts, we're going to send you back for a couple of years. But nobody said anything about North Korea. That wasn't even the same theater,
mm-hmm.
you know. So when that happened, I was on my way to check out my Liberty card to go out and count. And your Liberty's been secured. Go back and pack your shit and be out on the runway to wait for orders. They're getting cut right now. And they were trying to gather up Marines to make up a landing force to go and rescue the guys off their ship in North Korea. And I just thought, oh, fuck, you know. But you got to get as far as getting out on the airship with my stuff, you know. Didn't have a chance to call my girlfriend. Of course, we didn't have phones, you know. Or mm-hmm. let her know. Just didn't have any time to do anything. Just pack your shit and get out there. But it turns out, you know, they stood us down.
Yeah. That's some pretty exciting times there, to say the least, given that time that you were there in the Philippines.
Yeah, amazingly, so when I got back to the States, it got more exciting.
Is that right? Tell me about your return to the U.S. from the Philippines. What was the flight like? What was the reception like when you got back to the U.S.?
This was 1968. And we knew about all the protests were going on, but sure, I lived in Dallas. I came home to Dallas Love Field, and I was in uniform, and I'd only been gone a little over a year, you know, a year and a half or so, and I didn't see any protesters or anything. When we came back from the Philippines, I landed in Northern California at the Air Force Base there.
Mm-hmm.
So really had much exposure to civilians there. And I got in the civilian airport, and I was coming back as an individual, not as part of a large unit,
right.
That would, you know, be a lot of press and a lot of protesters would come out. So I saw a few signs and stuff, but nobody really bothered me. When I got back home, you know, I got back in civilian clothes and just spent some time there. I saw some old friends, and one of them. This girl and her family were real good friends of mine. When I went up there, they were all crying and everything. The reason was one of our other friends was in Hue, and he had just gotten killed. He worked at Hontos, and he got killed. And so rather than celebrating my comeback, we all mourned him. His funeral was they got him back, you know, a week or so. His funeral. So but it was pretty uneventful time at home. I really didn't do much. It was, I mean, Dallas, Texas for you know, I was 19 then. Dallas, Texas for a 19-year-old kid is nothing like the fucking Philippines, you know.
Mm, sure. I wonder if you could tell me about that. I mean, there's a very real difference from the life or death existence of Vietnam and then this, you know, this kind of craziness of the Philippines. What was it like for you to come back to a stable, semi-stable United States, especially Dallas, Texas? What was that like for you?
Well, it's just like, it's really strange, you know, because I was away from all my buddies. Everybody there, my friends were college. You know, I had a cousin who was in college there at SMU, so he and I grew up together, and that, you know. And I ran with him and his college buddies, so particularly before I deployed over there. And then, but it seemed like, you know, I'd aged 100 years, and those people were just, I mean, they were into such inconsequential stuff. And it was good to see them, and it was fun, but you know, we go out and have a few drinks, you know, at a party or something like that. But, man, this ain't nothing like partying with the Marines and the Filipino girls, you know?
Right.
Or the Ryukyuan whores in Okinawa, the bar fights and shit that we get. It was extremely anticlimactic. I had to go around and see all my family, you know, and stuff. And it was very, very anticlimactic.
Was it difficult for you to be around other people your age? And like you said, a lot of the stuff they were into was, you believe, was kind of inconsequential.
Yeah, my cousin and his fraternity friends, those were the buddies that I kind of met. And there was a couple of guys that were really sorry sons of bitches who I, of course, gravitated to. They were like Marines.
Right.
They had good Marine potential. And they like weapons. We go out and shoot weapons, and, you know, get drunk and stuff. But for the most part, you know, it's like their shit was really important. You know, like, you know, they were talking about me pledging to the fraternity when I got out of the Marine Corps and come back, you know, and all the real terrible shit that they do to haze people in their first year of college, you know, when they pledge to fraternity. You know, it's just, oh, you know, yeah, wow, that sounds like
yeah.
Really exciting. Thanks for warning me. You know? What the fuck? Yeah, but when I got back, I wish I could stay at home, but I didn't want to go back to Camp Pendleton because Camp Pendleton, I knew they were going to stick me out on a guard post somewhere or put me in some fucking thing. But I was about as wrong as I've ever been in my life. So I went back to Camp Pendleton.
How long of a leave did you have once you got back?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And
then
I got back to Camp Pendleton, and that's when hell started. You know.
Okay, take me through this time here at Camp Pendleton. Why do you say that?
I'll take you to the first step. When I was a kid, when I was 17 years old, filling out the application to join the Marine Corps, with my mother having to sign it,
mm-hmm.
That's for hobbies. And I told you why I had to join the Marines.
Right.
Because she didn't want me to be in the Army. She wanted me to be a paratrooper. I want to be a paratrooper. She wanted me to join the Army because they fucked me around. Navy, you know, I'd like to be a frogman, you know, but how does one get to be, I didn't know how you get to be a fucking frogman. But one of my hobbies was skin diving, and it was actually scuba diving. I got certified when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1964, we had a guy at our school who was a diver who could certify people, and I learned to dive, so I wrote that down. Thank God that wasn't the only training I ever got, but I wrote it down. And so when I was laying out on my sea bags on the tarmac there at Camp Pendleton waiting to get called in to get an assignment, they called just my name over the loudspeaker. And I'm laying there like I was in some kind of fucking trouble. And I went down the hallway, and there was a guy sitting behind the desk. And the first thing I noticed was these big, broad, fucking gold Navy jump wings, parachute wings. And he asked me a couple. He said, "Listen, hey, I've got your record here. I see that you made 100% on the two exams in boot camp. You didn't miss any questions. You have merit toast for long time." I said, "Well, yeah, I might have cheated a little bit because I had 4 years of ROTC, you know, the written exam. I still had to study like everybody else, but you know, that probably gave me a little bit of an advantage." He said, "Yeah, tell me about this hobby of yours, skin diving." I told him about that. He said, "Well, listen, I'm from 5th Force Recon. We're looking for infantry MOS combat experience to volunteer for Force Recon." And my fucking heart just started racing.
Did you know what Force Recon was?
You're goddamn right I didn't. Everybody in the Marine Corps does, you know. that's the equivalent of the Navy SEAL team,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I thought, you've got to be shit. I mean, I couldn't get the words out fast enough, you know. I was, that's once again, you know, you undergo a complete turnaround in your psyche. Here I was gonna languish out in some fucking guard post or some stupid training battalion or something like that. But no, fuck, man. Listen, you're going to have to pass a test, and you're going to do it today. And it's a physical fitness test. I'm a fucking physical wreck. You know, I smoke a pack a day, just come back from fucking nom. And but they took me on board the trip. It was a physical fitness test. It was more a test of, when we found out, a test of heart rather than cardiovascular conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would get you in shape. They just want to know if you could take all their shit for the rest of the afternoon.
Well,
and
can you describe that for me? What sort of things did they put you through?
Well, they said, you know, throw your gear on the back of this truck, and they drove me out to the Fifth Force Recon company area. It's just a company. That's all Recon is. Out by the boat base and near the beach. Okay, drop your gear, take your shirt off, you know, keep your boots, trousers, and your T-shirt on, and just stand by, and there'll be somebody come out here. And I think there was one or two people. Well, just maybe one or two of these guys with me. That's all. And they said, okay, well, let's go. And you don't walk, in Recon, you don't walk anywhere. We ran down to the beach. We probably ran a couple miles. They stopped at the motor pool and had to do, you know, hundreds of push-ups, pull-ups until your arms are just about to fall. Go down the back to the motor pool and crawl, do a low crawl through the oil, you know, where they drain the oil. This was back before we had a lot of this environmental shit, you know.
Sure.
Oil was just sitting in these little trenches, you know. Crawl through that, get up, run back out to the boat base. And again, this was in February, so the sea surface temperature out there off the coast of Southern California is probably 58 degrees. You know, run out and into the surf and come back up, do, you know, do push-ups, run another 2, 3, 4 miles, go back, do more pull-ups, and then here's another. We all knew all the exercises, the 8-count bodybuilders and squat thrusts and UDT. They even taught some new ones, you know, and run, push-ups, getting yelled at, you know, rolling in the sand. You have sand and oil just all over you, and it just, you're exhausted, you know. If you don't puke at least a couple of times, then you're not putting yourself out.
Mm.
And you never know when this is going to end. And it lasted all afternoon. And I could barely stand up when we got back to the company area. And they had me stand out there at parade rest while he went in and talked to the office there. Of course, I think that part of the exercise is to see how patiently we could wait out there at parade rest. And so, you know, they told us any time during this exercise, you just say the word. You don't have to do this. Just say, hey, look, this is not for me. I don't want to do this. I want to drop out. And then, you know, we'll get you back there and get you showered and get a meal and everything. And while you're waiting out there, listen, hey, you just went through a PT test. That's a typical day in recon. If you don't want to do this, just go ahead and have a seat over here. Let us know.
Hmm.
Otherwise, you stand the fuck there and you wait till we get back.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I did. And when they said, okay, you want to volunteer for Force Recon? And it was just with all the strength I had, it was just enough to say, well, yes, sir. I said, all right, get in and grab your shit. You start scuba school. And I had to draw the fins and mask and UDT vest. And next morning, I started dive training, which is all running and swimming. And shit, it's torture that you just absolutely fucking love, you know? And by that summer, by August, I finished Navy. It was actually a dive school run by underwater demolition team, and then got to a parachute jump school at Fort Benning. And you know, we were hot dogging with Force Recon. You know, and that's where I spent the rest of my tour. I absolutely fucking loved it.
And so this was in August.
Yeah, by August I had finished all this training. You do before the Marine Corps sends you to any service schools like jump school or scuba school, you have to already be trained to scuba dive, to jump out of airplanes, and to endure magnitudes more PT and physical torture than you could ever expect at one of these schools.
Mm-hmm.
So
it sounds like you took to this pretty well. This is something that you like to do.
Oh yeah, it's great. It's the first time in my life I'd ever made a decent, except for the exams in boot camp. You know, military, when I was in ROTC, I did okay on that, but I'd never done worth a shit in high school. You know, English, math, sciences, chemistry, but you had to do chemistry and physics for diving. You know, because that's what diving's all about. You know, the gas laws and everything. That's the first time I ever did really good academically and stuff like that.
So now that you're in Force Recon, what do you expect to do? Once you're certified, once you've graduated, once you're a member of Force Recon, What are you expecting to do as part of the service?
Well, four, three times you train, and I didn't know if I was going to stay in the Marine Corps. Now, once I got in the Force Recon, every idea that I had about getting out of the Marine Corps, you know, doing one enlistment, getting out,
mm-hmm.
I kind of put that by the wayside. And they were even talking about putting me up for possible officer's candidate school,
hmm.
you know, when I turned 21 and stuff. Of course, my enlistment would be up before I turned 21. And, I mean, Force Recon, you just... I mean, you're locking out of submarines out in the middle of the ocean and you know, swimming 5 miles at night. And it really is cool because you swim off a beach at night in the middle of the night, you know, four guys, and you go out, you swim 2 or 3 miles offshore, and you bang a couple little pipes together, be separated by a 30-foot rope, and you just bang these little pipes together. And after about 15, 20 minutes, submarine periscope will come and snag your line. Going about one night, you pull yourself up the periscope,
hmm.
scoop tanks up there, you put them in your mouth, and go back and lock into the submarine through the forward escape trunk. I mean, this kind of shit the 19-year-old kid is doing. I mean, this is, and skydiving and jumping out of airplanes with 150 pounds of shit on your back. I mean, it's just,
this seems crazy.
For that shit,
yeah.
You know?
Now, you had considered staying on a little bit longer, is that correct?
Yeah, I was considering it. You know, even and Force Recon was a real, it was higher mortality than the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there's also a chance that you wouldn't get killed. You know.
Yeah.
And so it's you know, I started to rethink. I mean, the thought of going back in the same situation that I had been in, absolutely terrifying to be unarmed. Against a well-armed, well-equipped, well-trained, and well-led enemy, just that scared me to death, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But recon, you had a little more attitude on your weapons, you know, and I thought of it a little bit different.
Yeah, even though it could possibly. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
But then, you know, that was like 1968. War started coming down that the Marines are gonna reduce their force in Vietnam, and you know protests got more, and there was a lot of sentiment that the war wasn't gonna last much longer, even though it did, but the Marine presence there after 1969 was going to draw back quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
and still although it lasted another couple of years, you know there was just as good a chance that. At the same time, you know, the war was old, and there's a lot of garrison stuff in the United States, even in recon, you know, a lot of inspections and a lot of bullshit. And that started to creep in,
yeah.
As I recall, in late 1968 and 1969. So with those prospects looming, and a promising civilian career waiting for me in the diving business in San Diego,
yeah.
I went ahead and got out at the end of my 3 years.
Okay, now you leave in 1969. What did you do at that point?
I got discharged from the Marine Corps in the afternoon, and the next morning I was standing tall at San Diego Diver Supply.
Hmm.
Selling diving equipment, doing, and I had to start out selling and learning stock and all that stuff, but I really was an instructor. That's
yeah.
what I wanted to do. And they sent me to instructor school, and this was about the time they started coming out with a lot of things we're using today, the big Boise compensated vest, and well, at least consoles, they didn't use those back then,
mm-hmm.
and I got, you know, the San Diego's where diving started in the United States, and the San Diego Divers were the first company, so I got right in on a lot of the newest equipment and stuff the manufacturers were making, and got tested on deep dives out off the coast of San Diego, and we made a series of deep dives between 150 and 250 feet, testing some of this new equipment and stuff. It was fascinating.
Mm. Well, I bet it was.
You know, I enrolled in the oceanography and marine technology course in the college there, and it was a pretty good life.
What was it like for you, for a guy, a three-time wounded Marine in Vietnam and then a Force Recon Marine, to enter civilian life where you're having to learn stock and sell supplies and do these kinds of things, in addition to the other things you're doing, like the deep dives and the training and things like that? What was it like for you to to become a full-time civilian after this previous 2 years of just incredible activity, yeah, excitement,
well,
fear?
The most striking thing was that I worked with civilians, and there were a lot of guys in college who went to San Diego State.
Mm-hmm.
And these were liberal mama's boys, they didn't like me right from the start because I said yes, sir, to the store manager. The store manager, Kevin Murphy, he was a retired Navy SEAL.
Hmm.
And, I mean, this guy fell in love with me on my interview because when I came in to interview for the fucking job, I had the Marine Recon haircut. It's just no hair at all except for a little horseshoe on the top. And I stood at parade rest and called him sir. And this guy, I asked him later, you know, this is several years later. I said, hey, Kevin, was the reason you hired me because I was in recon and because I had all this experience? He says, no, you know, Del, I'll tell you what. Real reason I hired you because when I interviewed you stood at parade rest and you called me sir. I haven't had any other employee in 15 years do that.
I'm sure. Well, how did you get along with the civilians that you would have to deal with?
Oh, none of them had much of a brain, and none of them had any spine or any balls at all.
Hmm.
They're all mama's boys. Mom and dad take care of everything. But since mom and dad had everything covered, they really thought they were in hog heaven. I mean, they thought they had a good command of all the realities in life, and they could categorize, you know, people in the middle class, upper class, lower class, typical. This bullshit, the social economic bullshit they learned at San Diego State and college, you know, fraternities. And a couple of them, I got along pretty good, you know. But there were some really weird turds there that thought they'd been in the diving business there. Of course, they weren't instructors. All they did was, you know, spend the time in the shop and doing stock and knew how to sell and stuff. So they thought that made them hot shit. Where I was going, you know, be an instructor and taking all this new shit out in the ocean and testing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it took them a while before they realized that you just don't get this fucking guy and start giving them more. You know, the thing was that here, they come up about 11 o'clock in the morning, 11:30, and put a wad of bills in my hand and a list. Say, listen, we want some food. It's your turn to go to some fucking restaurant that gives takeout shit. And this is for Bill. This is for Joe. This is for Jeff. And come back and here's enough money. This should cover it all. And you know, I said, fuck you. You know, I don't really get your fucking lunch. Get the fuck out of here. You know? And then they looked at, you know, how the liberals do. They look like it's the greatest shock they ever had. Like this guy, you know, who's new here is not going to run to the fucking restaurant in his own car and buy the lunch or even the paying for it, you know, bring it back and manage all this fucking food. I said, fuck, I don't want any of their shit, you know.
Right.
And I don't want you to give me any of it when you go there, you know. Don't bother with that shit, you know.
Right. How long did you have this job?
So I got to medical school. This was April 2nd, 1969 is when I started, and I was with San Diego Divers in one capacity or another until I left for medical school in June of 1974.
So you were there a good long while.
I was either full time with them, you know, working in the store, teaching. I would teach several classes a week. San Diego Divers got to be contractor too. To teach classes for the National Science Foundation for a summer program they had for high school students of this private school. And then they also taught the San Diego Harbor Police, and they taught the classes at UCSD. And I was the instructor that they assigned to do all of that stuff because of my experience in diving. Number two, because of my experience with all the new stuff that was coming out and all the series of deep dives. Number three, because you know, these other assholes with their liberal arts and their history majors and their social studies majors. I was the one studying chemistry, calculus, and physics, and oceanography. You know, I was actually a major in marine technology before I went to UCSD, so they had me teaching all that stuff, you know.
Now, I wonder, as a teacher, as an instructor, did you find that you had to dial yourself back a little bit, or did you just let it rip like a marine would?
Oh no! They at first I probably did. Yeah, I probably was a little. I went a little bit Marine Corps on people, you know. And then they pulled it. So I said, "No, let's talk to you, okay? we're not sending these people out to kill. We're training them to die so they can have fun and they can come back and buy hundreds of dollars worth of our equipment. You got to remember that. So, yeah, that's right. So that's why, you know, that's probably another reason why they have a teacher, the Harbor Police, and the UCSD class, you know. UCSD class is good. I mean, you think this is, they're probably a bunch of liberal colleges, but by this time, you know, I never lost my Marine identity. I always had, I have torn bell bottoms and a Mexican wedding shirt, but it had jungle boots at the bottom of it or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had hair down to my shoulders and a beard down to my tits. But, and so I was a little more accepted. Once my hair grew out, my beard grew, I was a little better accepted.
Yeah. Right, kind of fit in a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
At least look wise.
Plus, by that time, this is San Diego,
mm-hmm.
and it's the home of the fucking fleet is there. You know, so you've got all kinds of active and reserves and retired Navy and Marines there. So,
mm-hmm.
Those guys they're going to be in college too, and they're going to be working too, and you're going to gravitate toward each other, and you'll
gravitate
out group,
yeah,
like-minded people.
Now, you alluded to this before, earlier in the interview, but explain to me why you chose medical school. This does not sound like something that John Del Camber, the Marine, would be interested in following.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, it was what I call flashbacks. It happened pretty fast. I think I was probably, I'd had chemistry already and had one semester of calculus and stuff. But I started to have these flashbacks, and the flashbacks, not, you know, North Vietnamese waiting around every corner to ambush, but the flashbacks were the Navy corpsmen. They took care of me and the other Marines, and they did, you know, these, you know, as tired as everybody was, they would, you know, stay up in these hills that we'd go through.
Hello?
You know, take care of us when we're wounded. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Yes.
Yeah, okay. And then the other one that really stood out, that, remember I told you about that Navy doctor? I'm sure he was a doctor, a surgeon or something. Or he could have been a nurse, I don't know, but he had the jungle boots and the bloody scrubs and the stethoscope around his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no fucking idea how bad I was hurt. And he said, okay, well, don't worry, Marine, you're going to be all right.
Right.
And all that stuff. Probably within a matter of about a month, you know, it's a calling that you get. And I changed my major at the end of that semester.
And where did you go to? Where did you go to medical school?
Right there where you are. I was in the third graduating class.
Is that right?
Yeah, Texas Tech. When we got the new UMC medical building there,
mm-hmm.
that was a cow pasture when I started medical school in 1974. And the paint wasn't even dry when we graduated in 77.
Now, why did you choose Texas Tech?
Say, dear God, chose that for me. Everything got fucked up.
Explain that.
Well, here, you know, I'm in California. I'm a student at UCSD, right?
Right.
So, naturally, you'd want to go to someplace in California. Well, the residency requirements in California, there aren't any. You can be from any state in the country, be anywhere in the world, and apply to a California school, and you have as good a chance of getting in as somebody who can win residency there.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Texas gave a preferential admission to Texas state residents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and if you're applying for medical school back in 1974, you need to understand that there's 50 people who are applying for every position in medical school. So you've got 49 other people that you've got to beat out for a place. And so you want to send out applications to every medical school that you can list. I mean, so I spent months just filling out applications and sending them everywhere. You know, University of Texas everywhere, Vanderbilt this, University of California, everywhere. But see, I was living in California. So in order to give myself a better chance, there's only one other state that I could claim residence in, but I needed to work fast. Now it's Texas. The reason I could claim Texas is because that was the last place I lived when I joined the Marine Corps,
okay.
And I never went back. So I could still use Texas, but I had to establish a Texas address. I had to get a Texas driver's license, which I didn't have. I was California, and I had to open up a Texas bank account. Those things would qualify you as a Texas resident. So I used my grandmother's apartment address in Dallas. I came back and got a Texas driver's license using that address and opened up a Texas bank account in Dallas over Preston State Bank using that address over there in Highland Park in Dallas. And so I sent all this shit out to medical schools. And Texas Tech, it was a new medical school. And it was one of the first applications I sent out. So I got a couple of letters back from others. And, so listen, we appreciate your interest in our school and all this blah, blah, blah bullshit. But due to the nature of our, we can't consider your application. I mean, Vanderbilt and, Columbia and shit like that. But, so anyway, I got a letter from Texas Tech to come to an interview. This was in January of 1974. And I thought, okay, here they come, So I'm starting to get interviews now. And so I was celebrating. I got shit-faced. I got drunk one afternoon, got on the plane and flew out. And I shouldn't be telling you because you're in Texas Tech. I know it. But we'll go ahead and take care of this interview. And I'll wait for the other Texas universities to write me,
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't heard from them yet. And so I came out and I flew out to Lubbock. What happened that night or that day is Texas was engulfed by a series of terrible, terrible, terrible storms that delayed every plane in Texas. Well, hell, it didn't delay anything coming out of San Diego. Fuck, I got right here,
Mm-hmm.
I got through a break in the clouds. I had to change planes somewhere. I don't even remember where it was, but I got to Lubbock before everybody else. And they had extra time to interview me with one-on-one Dr. Lorraine Schultz. So she was a pathologist there. She was the first one to meet me. And since there were, the other kids were late, she spent a little more time. She went over a lot of the Marine Corps stuff with me and a lot of the ocean stuff, and just got to talking, and I had sobered up by that time, so I probably made a better impression, although I thought I would have until I saw the other guys when they started to arrive. He had a bunch of college kids in three-piece suits and white teeth and $50 haircuts, and I was in my usual. I thought I looked pretty good. My Levi's were pretty clean. I had a corduroy coat on, open shirt collar and boots that one or two scuffed up, And I stood out like a sore fucking thumb.
Hmm.
But anyway, I had a beard. I had a beard, like I said, down on my tits, and all these other guys were clean shaven. So anyway, we got in, you do a one-on-one, and then you do a round table with two other applicants and three faculty on the admissions committee. And I actually had been doing a lot of research. The Scientific American September 1971 issue devoted the entire issue to medical care in the United States. And very similar to the problems we have today, just, a little bit different shade of here and there. But you read that, you can familiarize yourself with that whole issue. You're pretty conversive when you come in to visit with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so that evidently the other two guys the other thing that helps you is you're out on your own. You're taking care of your own health insurance. You're paying your own rent. Mom and Dad haven't taken care of you since you were 17 years old,
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of comes through also. But that was an extremely good roundtable interview for me, and it was extremely poor for the other two guys that were there. And I have to say, and there's something happening that I wasn't aware of at the time. The old postman who knew me, my grandmother, since I was a kid, either died or retired, and he was replaced by another postman. Every goddamn letter that I got from everywhere else on the fucking planet that got sent to that address, since my name was not on the box, it was hers. Her name was Lillian Rush, and my John Bill Cambridge. I said, this fucking guy doesn't live here. So they sent it all back.
Huh.
So about March or April, I started, hey, let's find out what's going on. I haven't got any more letters. I got any fucking mail at all. So I ran this down and found out that's what happened. And I went absolutely through the fucking roof, man. I thought, shit, I wonder what, if Texas Tech has called to offer me a place, and I never got back. I said, oh, fuck. So I got on the phone to Texas Tech, asked them, unfortunately, said, no, we're still considering applications there. We haven't chosen it. The class size, now Texas Tech, I think, have 150 in the class. It's only 36 that year, anyway, I went on and on and on, hadn't heard anything, so I figured in May I checked again, they had still hadn't made a decision, and so me and another guy, gonna make some money, we were gonna go up to Alaska and work on the pipeline, which they were still building at the time, and I was gonna make enough money to come back and try again. If I couldn't get into American Medical School, I was gonna go to Guadalajara, New Mexico, and just before the end of the last quarter of school, I got a call from Dr. Hartman, who was he's an orthopedic surgeon there at Texas Tech, and he asked me if I was still interested in a place in the July class. And I think that must have been around May 30th or June 1st. I don't know, but I really started to soar after that.
Huh. And,
went from San Diego to Lubbock. That's another culture shock if you haven't experienced it.
Yet. Yes, yes, indeed.
UCSD
it is.
UCSD was at the top of a cliff over one of the world famous nude beaches, the Black's Beach. I used to go there surfing and diving. They go there, and I live in a fucking one room apartment in Lubbock, Texas, before school starts,
Welcome home, Doc. Well, that's an incredible way to go about getting into medical school, and obviously you did well, and you've been a surgeon, a physician surgeon for the rest of your career.
Yeah, it's a series of unpredictable, rare accidents that put me where I ended up.
That's incredible. Did you continue to pay attention to what was going on in Vietnam during this time?
Yeah, you're always interested in that, always interested. I was in medical school in 1975 when Saigon fell and Phnom Penh fell and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And Muhammad Ali beat George Foreman. Knew that, There's one other guy in my class who was a Vietnam veteran. He was an Air Force pilot. And another buddy of mine, he never went overseas, so he was a veterinarian, Army Veterinary Corps.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew what was going on.
Yeah. What were your thoughts on how the war was continuing to be fought and, of course, the fall of Saigon, et cetera?
Actually, by that time, if I had never gotten into what I'd gotten into with medical school, I probably would have been down at the VFW smoking cigarettes and, lining up empty bottles and Lone Star long necks, because that's how I perceive a lot of the other veterans. But if you're hell bent on medical school and being at the top of everything you do, it's Vietnam. I'm glad that I was able to participate in and survive. Knew there was nothing else I could do about it. Knew the country a whole lot better. I knew the attitudes and the psyches of the conservatives and liberals and the people who made up not only the country but the government too. I was headed pretty fast in an entirely different direction in medical school.
Yeah,
and there was a whole lot more to worry about.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it served a variety of purposes, not just a career, but it gave you something else to focus on and to redirect your energies in a positive way toward improving yourself and getting your degree and going on to your career. Because, as you said, you saw these other things, these other parts of society that could have led you in a different direction. So it sounds like it really worked out well in a variety of ways for you.
Yeah, as evidence that I never really forgot about it, I went back in 1990.
You've made a number of trips you've been to Southeast Asia since you came back from Vietnam. You've been, I believe, to Iraq or Afghanistan. Tell me about this. How did all this come about? What was this about?
Well, in 1979, after a series of border clashes, Vietnam invaded Cambodia and put an end to the domination of the Khmer Rouge Pol Pot, had been there since 1975, and the Pol Pot more detail than I did, but he reduced the population in Cambodia from 6 million down to 3 million by running people into exile and murdering, mostly murdering people.
Mm-hmm.
When Vietnam invaded, just as they were just about reestablish, one thing that Pol Pot did is he, you know, Cambodia had been completely dependent on other countries for help in the United States. He had almost restored rice self-sufficiency. We're back in the 12th century in Angkor. They used to have five rice harvests a year. You know, harvesting the force of the Mekong River from the Himalayas. But anyway, when Vietnam invaded, they destroyed all of that, and they sent, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees over the Thai-Cambodian border, not only Cambodian, but Vietnamese refugees, and that was a huge international crisis. Mm-hmm. And the most impressive they got was when Rosalynn Carter went over there, and I was a third-year resident, and that's one of those things that happened pretty fast. I just thought, you know, I've been out of war for 13 years, and I'm starting to get a Jones for adrenaline, you know, and that's it. So I volunteered to lead an American Red Cross team with the International Red Cross at the border. And fortunately for me, my surgery program director, Scott White, was an old Navy surgeon who operated on the Marines in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew Marines were fucking crazy. And he was always giving me shit about it. He loved them. He just never would admit it. And I didn't even tell him. I didn't tell him for a day before I left. I said, listen, I got something come up, and I'm just going to do it. I can't explain it. And people would tell me, you know, when I came back, I was there for 3 months. I come back in the jungle. I came back and I said, God damn, Doctor, how the fuck did you ever get Dr. Broders to let you go on this goddamn thing? I said, fuck, I was going anyway. The wonder is how the fuck he ever let me come back.
What was the nature of your work on this?
I led an American team into the border, right into Cambodia, and we were surrounded by four warring factions. We had the Khmer Rouge, the communists who we treated. We had to go to air camps to treat them. The Khmer Sarai, then the Vietnamese army was going up and down there, trying to fight the Khmer Sarai and the Khmer Rouge. Then on the other side of this gray area called the border, you had indistinguishable from an American armored and airborne division, you had the Thai army. And then you had the thieves, brigands, pirates, and bandits in the jungle that preyed on the refugees. And it was probably one of the most exciting until I got deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Most exciting things I ever done. Like we had to operate out of the back of a truck. There was no facility. You know, everything that stood was built out of bamboo. I treated diseases that Western doctors only read about, you know, cholera, polio, leprosy, things like that, you know, tuberculosis. It was incredible. Yeah. And then I operated on war wounds, and it was amazing. that was a little over 2 months, and we came back to Scott and White.
That must have been incredible. What an incredible experience.
Yeah, it was. It was great. Then it hit me again. They hit me again in 1986 when the Russians were in Afghanistan, and the International Medical Corps, when they were volunteers. I was in private practice at the time. I was married to the mother of my oldest boys, and she was pregnant with my second son. And I left for a couple of months to go there. Right where nobody can go now, you know, in the Hindu Kush Mountains where all the tribal regions are.
Right.
There's a lot of fire up there.
Wow.
With the Mujahideen, there was no Taliban back then.
Right.
The Mujahideen, the Freedom Fighters, and the Americans weren't the bad guys back then. You know?
Right. Yeah. And was it the same type of operation here? The same kinds of things you'd be doing? War wounds and diseases.
Did a lot more training with medics, Mujahideen medics, and then did a lot of outpatient, the clinical treatment of a lot of these diseases. Then they did have some makeshift hospitals around there that I'd go and operate at with Afghan surgeons, and it was very exciting again. But I spent a lot more time training Mujahideen medics. We had a goat lab. We'd go out and buy goats, and we'd teach them how to put these goats. So we used ether. You know, that's all he has, ether. going to start IVs and give IV value and morphine on both. And so it really, then you take care of patients, and it was, and then we were able to travel up and down, stuff that, no American could ever go down.
Yeah. That's absolutely fascinating, Dr. Delcambre.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. What a career that was.
Yeah, it was fun.
Well, I've got just a couple more questions for you, very general questions that I tend to ask all of the veterans that I interview. One is, as you look back on your experiences there in the Vietnam War, in Vietnam, in the Marine Corps, how do you think your Vietnam experiences have most affected your life?
Everything else that ever happens to you after Vietnam happens because of Vietnam.
Can you explain that to me?
Yeah. Like I said, where I am now is a result of a chain of unexpected and unpredictable accidents. But like I said, you develop a way of thinking that never leaves you. I mean, you can add to and modify it, but there's a culture that you develop that will be with you for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who's been there, it doesn't matter what service you're in, you sense that about other people who've been there with you. There's that bond there.
All right, now my final question. Again, very broad question. Over the years, we've kicked the Vietnam War around in a variety of different ways, whether it's for political reasons or whatever it might be. We try to decide the Vietnam War meant this. No, here's what we should learn from the Vietnam War. We continue to struggle as a society with what the legacy of the Vietnam War is. I want to ask you, as a Vietnam veteran, what do you think is the legacy of the Vietnam War? What does it all mean historically?
It's a legacy of mistakes despite all the disasters, there's a lot of good that's come from it. With our determination to fight communism, although we might not have prevailed there, capitalism prevailed over communism with fall of the Soviet Union. At least in that regard. Of course, now. You could argue that that socialism is trying to take over capitalism here. But,
that's a whole different story.
we didn't win that. And the Berlin Wall fell. When the Berlin Wall fell, I spent the money that it took to buy a German Stein on the top of which was a piece of the Berlin Wall. And my kids have that now. I thought that was a real big hallmark, and I thought part of the reason that came about is because the United States was able to fight, lose all these 58,000 people, and recover from that. And that's part of it. The other thing is, if you look around, a lot of the greatest scientists and engineers and public figures right now in our country. What's their names? Their name is Tho and Nguyen and things like that. These are talking Vietnamese that have immigrated here. And if we had never been involved in that war, if that war had never happened, we probably wouldn't benefit from the great things that those people are doing in our country now.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever have to worry about them attacking us or blowing themselves up or anything like that, or trying to do anything but contribute to our society.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we close up the interview then?
No, I think that's all I can think of. I wrote a whole book on it. So there's a lot more detail in that, but that's probably pretty much the meat and potatoes of that.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and stop the interview then.